All right, Tuesday, May 21st, 2019. This is a Josephine County Board of Commissioners, 9 a.m. general discussion. No surprise, it's 9 a.m. Our first item is an OSU Extension Program's presentation. Please introduce yourself. Have a seat if you'd like.
Okay. My name is Sue Hunt, and I work for Oregon State University Extension. I'm the 4-H faculty member for this county and also what's called the county leader. So I kind of oversee the offices when our regional director is not in town.
Hey,
good morning. So we're here to present to you. This is our 2019 presentation, but we're covering for some of us 2017 and 2018 because of where our program years run with our programs. Like ours runs from October through the end of September. So right now we're in our next year, so we're presenting for that. Me for the last year.
When is your fiscal?
Well, our fiscal does not match our program years.
Got it.
Okay, our fiscal runs July 1st through June. Our program year runs October 1st through the end of September.
Okay.
So why?
Life gets exciting. Why? Because that's the way we enroll kids. It's like, you know, when school starts
like
and so on.
You're following the
yes.
school curriculum.
And we right. used to follow that, but then because of the way our nonprofits run and so on, we were all told we had to be on the same schedule as university, which is June 1st through the end of July. So, anyway,
funding
works
differently. And your checks have that little OSU logo up in the corner,
yes.
so
you'll
listen. Good idea.
Absolutely.
I'm catching on.
Okay. So,
so
some of us will speak, you know, to a little more recent things, some of us a little more past because of the data that we have.
So historically, sometimes they throw this in the same time as yesterday, sometimes not. So it's kind of nice to have it separate.
A separate presentation.
Yes. Yeah. We used to do it with the budget, and that got really long. And everybody said, yeah, no,
everybody got tired.
Now.
And
yeah.
said, nah. Okay.
Yeah.
Understandable.
Is it going to work?
Is it going?
It's going. Hold on. Let's try it one more time.
Made the lights go on in there. I'm not sure how
you did
that.
Good job on the lights, yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, the gates
it,
out
it is
going
on. It does say green.
Try it again.
All right. There we go.
We got one.
All right. So I just thought for the first slide, we'd just look at what the Extension Service mission is for a minute, which is obviously to serve the community with research-based knowledge education in order to strengthen our communities, the economy, sustain our natural resources, and promote healthy families and individuals. So that's the focus of all of our programs. And then each one of us, at least for 4-H, we have our own mission and vision because we're working with young people. So this is the order of our presenters today. I'll be talking about 4-H. Sarah will be doing small farms and community horticulture. Karen will be doing family and community health, master food preservers. Cheryl will be family and community health and nutrition education. Small farms. Maud is unfortunately ill today, so we're going to try and piece in what we all know from working with her. Forestry and Natural Resources is Max Bennett, and Agriculture is Gordon Jones, who is fairly new to our team, and we haven't done an agriculture per se presentation before, so this is kind of exciting.
Hey, we're happy to have that.
Yeah. So, my first part is all about 4-H, and this is Oregon's vision for 4-H. And, of course, we still keep hearing, I can't do 4-H because I don't have room for an animal. So it's amazing how often it still comes up. Folks are really amazed when they find out, guess what, we do a whole lot more than that. So we've come a long way for our cows and corn and canning, which is the initial focus of the program way back 100-plus years ago. It was focused on the product. We've come a ways in that now we're no longer focused on the product, but we're focused on the kids. Our job is to put them on this trajectory that will lead them to an adulthood that has health and well-being, economic stability, social success, and civic engagement, which is what our focus of our programs are to be. All right. So we're looking for high-quality learning experiences, positive interactions with adults and peers. Some of this needs to really be sustained over time with active participation for them and opportunities to make meaningful contributions to the world around them. And I'll speak to a little bit more of that when we look here in a minute at the new model that we're using for 4-H and is starting to spread across the country. Let's go. There we go. So we have a researcher up at the university who's been working on this model for the last couple of years and is now training across the nation, and this may become the national model for 4-H, which is really cool. It speaks to the first thing we really want to find out is what excites youth, and it's that little part called youth spark, and that's what we want to build on. When I was raising my kids, the thing was delight-directed studies. If you find something they're excited in, you can tie all this other education into that. They're going to want to be motivated to learn. And that's what we want, is those kids that are motivated to learn, to seek out more information, and to grow, which will put them on this trajectory here, which gives them this openness to challenge and discovery, which we call a growth mindset, which says that I don't have to have the talent, I can learn things. If I put in time, energy, and effort, I can learn, I can get better.
Look at us. I'm just kidding.
Okay, there you go.
No, don't.
Not very long.
Yes. Yeah. And we want them to have this...
What, you know, you say all they have to do is put in time and energy and effort. How do you get them to do that?
And
some of them just
exactly
flat
it.
Aren't motivated to do anything.
So it's finding that spark. Okay. You have to find what is of interest to them, and sometimes that takes quite a while. You know, maybe trying different things, and I'll have an example at the very end that I'm probably going to cry when I tell you about, but it's yeah.
Steel yourself.
Yeah, it gets your heart, so... And so if they can exhibit these characteristics, and we can give them opportunities to work on these six different indicators here, then we know they're on this thriving trajectory. At least so far, that's what our data is telling us, which will give us these developmental outcomes, which I'm sorry are kind of hard to read, but we're talking about academic success, academic motivation. We're talking about having good self-confidence, having been able to work socially with other people, and so on. And then that's the long-term outcomes of having... You know, that adulthood that's marked by economic stability, health, well-being, all those things. There we go.
Do you have a tiered program or anything, you know, that says, okay, this person has gone through all of this in 4-H, and I'll use the Eagle Scout.
Yeah, the Boy Scout model.
The Boy Scout model of, like, you know...
Yeah, merit badges.
Yeah.
I was in the Boy Scouts.
Or level Cub Scouts to it, whatever
but
to
but
Boy
it
Scouts.
Is,
to
it
call
is
advanced,
amazing when you talk to people and you think, gosh, that guy is dynamic. You go, yeah, I was an Eagle Scout.
Yeah.
And you go, whoa. You know, my brother, ex-brother-in-law, he was in charge of all Boy Scouts of America in the Pacific Northwest region. And I thought, oh, boy, a professional Boy Scout. But holy cow, was he a smart individual.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an Eagle Scout. And you talk to people and say, yeah, well, boy, you're just really something. Where do you know? I was an Eagle Scout. And that was just forming the basics, mm-hmm. I think, kind of what you're doing here is you are forming a pathway. And when
correct.
They get to that,
yep.
they can almost do anything.
Yeah. And the thing with the little difference between Boy Scouts, my son was an Eagle Scout, by the way. Is that they have the merit badges, and they learn this much, but then they're done, and they move on to this merit badge. So it gives them a wide breadth of knowledge about many, many different things. Ours is working on that spark and saying, if this is what you're interested, pursue it as far as you want to go.
Okay. Mm.
So we're staying on that same path and helping them grow that particular area.
Right, so you're not dirtying up their process with all these other things just to get
yeah.
a badge. You're focused. You're more focused.
Yeah. And then, you know, if that doesn't work, then why don't you try this over here? So we're
right.
asking them to try different things.
Trying to be a little more nimble.
Yeah. yeah. And then focus on those things that they're really, really interested in. So the four areas that we kind of work in is this belonging, mastery, independence, and generosity. And they'll grow from, and again, I'll talk about this in a minute because I've got slides for each of these. Come on.
If you need me us to tap buttons, we will. Too.
Okay. So our basic hallmark program is obviously the clubs. That's where 4-H grew up. That's how all things have developed. And that's what our club a year ago looked like program. We had we were reaching 378 youth on a year-long basis with 81 volunteers and 18 clubs in the area. Then we worked a little bit with SMILE. We worked with Kids Zones to give them smaller little samplings of things. And we really began this Junior Master Gardener program, which is going at Highland Elementary right now, which is out in the school garden. And they're piloting this program for us. We're working with them to develop it and then be able to train more volunteers. We did a presentation to the school district. They said, yeah, we want it in all our schools. I said, great, send us volunteers. Because we can't do it by ourselves, obviously.
True.
We need you guys to buy in and help.
Can you have a consolidated, in other words, you have one area that all the schools can use, and instead of having a garden at every school. Of course, I guess that wouldn't work because you have to
bounce
back
and forth. Can't get back and forth. Yeah,
because the kids come out lunchtime, they come out after school, and all those kinds.
Sue, are you when you say kid zone up there? Is that Club Northwest Kid Zone?
Yeah.
Are you talking about? Okay.
Yeah, did some classes out there. All right, so these are the project areas that we currently have, or at least last year when we were doing it, that we currently have going and volunteers to be able to work with kids in. One of the areas we do not have is natural sciences, you know, which is the outdoor stuff, and so I'm hoping with this outdoor school initiatives, and as that's growing, and again, the funding is through OSU kind of, and, you know, we've done, over the years, so many camps and everything, we can help people train their counselors and so on if they're struggling in the schools to be able to get that going. But I think that's going to also help feed this and get kids interested again in being outdoors, learning about these different subject areas, and hopefully then popping up some volunteers that are willing to take kids on year-long trips through each of these different areas.
What's the OWH?
Oregon Western Heritage, which is a Western Action Shooting Program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just was worried to see the word owl after pistol.
Oh. So. Yeah, it's Oregon West. They're learning about the history of Oregon. They come up with kind of a persona of, you know, back in the 1860s, what would my persona be like and what kind of jobs would I have, my career, the things I would work with, a name and so on.
Gunslinger.
Yeah, well, no.
Gun hawk. I think they called them gun hawks back then.
Do you have volunteers in teaching all these areas enough?
Yes. No, never. I mean, I actually had a dad one time who called and said, could you do nuclear engineering? I said, absolutely. Come be a volunteer, find somebody else, get me five kids, we got it going.
Okay.
So we can pick any subject. That's the kind of cool thing about it.
Well,
you have to have the interest.
I don't know what your networks are as far as asking for more volunteers, but if there are any of these, that you guys can reach out to us and let us know, hey, we could use somebody in leadership development, or we can use somebody in woodworking, or blah, blah, blah. Let us know, and we can also access our networks and see if we can get the word out.
Okay. Yeah, basically it's, you know, like kids coming with their parents and saying, oh, we want to learn about this. It's like, okay, cool. Whoops. One too many. So this is kind of, that slide didn't come out right because over the side was the category. But these were hours that were put in during that year actually teaching in those different project areas. These are man hours, which came out to a total of roughly 1,500. Yeah, 1,435. So you can kind of see horse is one of the bigger project areas, at least time-wise. The other ones don't quite take as much. There's a lot in the horse project that you can learn and a lot of things that the kids do.
So. Horses are bigger.
They are, yes. And they're, you know, kind of like with the auction animals, kids actually get some payback at the end. With the horses, you just keep feeding them. So the payback is the work and the learning and all that kind of stuff, the education. All right. So their chance at independence comes through all these different ways, you know, being club officers, running business meetings, having the opportunity to choose what is interested them, which is, again, following their spark, opportunity to determine what they want to exhibit county fair. It's not a mandated thing that when you take a project you have to exhibit. It's up to them to choose. So they can choose what they want to put in, if they want to put in, if they want to get involved in that area. And then some of them choose to then send it on to state and see how well they'll do at that particular level. And then other activities that we have going on more at the county level, the state level. Again, all of these I'm seeing growth in different things that we do. Youth Voices in Action is a state, know your state government. It's what we used to call it, so that they'll go up and speak to the representatives, see how the Senate, see how the House of Representatives is run, and so on. And again, you know, my vision would have loved to have something we could do locally for know your county government. How do you guys work?
Do you have a robotics program at all?
I'm getting there. Yep. Summer conference, we take the kids up for 4 days. They get to stay in the dorm, eat dorm food, get to take classes, and kind of learn what that thing is about. There's like 90 classes that we offer over 2 days' time.
Well, at the campus of OSU?
Yep.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
I wish somebody had taken me into boot camp in the Navy. I probably wouldn't have joined.
That we don't do.
If you told them what it was.
I might have a different story.
Yeah, and then they start telling their friends, and they have a great time. And so this year, going at the end of June, and I've already got 9 kids signed up to go. So
they're trying to make little Beaver fans, I think.
Good for them. I'm all for it.
There you go.
Go Beavs.
And then we have our National Congress and National 4-H Conference, which takes place nationally. They meet a lot of other kids, you know, like 1,300 4-Hers from around the United States and the world. I'm also getting some families, again, reinterested in international exchanges. We used to have like a program of we bring 20 Japanese kids in during the summertime just for 4 weeks to live with families. Then that kind of disappeared, and so started to get a little bit of interest again. So
there's a friends of ours have own the Alborg Ranch over in Eastern Oregon, outside Steens Mountain, and they have sometimes two, but most of the time just one Japanese person that they sponsor over, and he lives on the ranch. Their ranch, if you look at a ranch in Japan, it's the size of this room, and they may have two or three cows in the size of this room.
Yeah.
Then you get on a 825,000 acre ranch with I don't know how many thousands of head of cattle. They're blown away of the vastness that they're completely unaware of living in Japan. But it's a pretty good experience for them. They live there for a year and then they go back.
Cool.
And, it's really helpful.
Yeah, and we do have year-long exchanges too, not only with Japan, with some South American countries, European countries. And so on, that they can bring to the state. But it's all run at more at a national 4-H level. It's called 4-H State Center Exchange that we run our program through. So,
what's the youngest in the program?
What's the what?
Youngest age? Is it 12?
Five years old.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, we have a program which is called Clover Buds, and that's for our 5 through 8-year-olds. And basically, they don't take on projects in clubs like the other kids do. What they do is they work on activities because it's not a... I want to get this product at the end. It's, how do I work with you? I want what you have, and how do we learn how to share, and just have activities and just kind of have fun together.
And I know we have to let you get through this. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Because we'll be here all day.
That's right, because of all these other... So I don't want to be the longest talking. Went one too far again.
Oh, here's the 4-H's. She's trying
to
go.
That's right. There it is. Whoops, too far. One click. Maybe it's a lag. There it is. All right. So, I do ask my folks to do paperwork, which they are not happy with, and I've tried to track as many of the community service hours, so this is just a really rough estimate of what they report to me that they've done. And again, this is only club-level community hours. This has nothing to do with individuals or families that go out and the things that they do, nor does this have anything at all to do with all the time and effort put into putting on county fair. I mean, there's just so much time and energy there, I can't even track that. So.
What do they do for a memorial service?
That happened to be the one that was for Mr. Buckmaster.
Got it.
Okay. So, because it impacted our program a lot of folks were there helping get that up, running, going, and serving what was going on at that time. And again, so these are tied to, this is the hidden stuff that we teach them without them even realizing it, because it's just part of the way they have to do things. So, stuff with their head, all their managing and thinking skills, caring and relating skills with their heart, giving and working skills with their hands, and being and living with their health. And they get exposed to careers through all of the volunteers and what they do for their life, because we have them from all walks of life. Let's do it again.
Walk along. We might need to do battery in our clicker.
Hey, there we go. Oh, no, it went by. Anyway, I can just tell you, we've got teachers, EMTs, firefighters, engineers, construction workers, horse trainers. It goes on and on and on. People with all walks of life come and want to share the information that they have, knowledge they have of either their careers or things that they do, so on. So this was the part I was going to cry about. I had this parent come to me. Why do we do 4-H? This is one of the very major reasons. She was in tears and just came and said, I'm just so grateful for you guys. A year ago, her daughter, she was withdrawn, on suicide watch. She didn't feel like she fit in anywhere. And she says, today she's happy, she's engaged, she feels like she has value and belong. And I truly believe 4-H saved her life.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
I think that's what everybody's looking for.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's that kid that feels lost in the system and everything that's going on, doesn't know how to relate, how to fit. And she's finally found a group where she can be comfortable and have that sense of belonging. So we thank you for your support and all the cool things you guys do for us and keeping us, I know we're top on your minds many, many times when you talk to other people. And I thank you. So those are just some of the different things. So you were asking about robotics. I've been doing it for 10 years with the program. And this is our new little guy that we're going to be introducing this fall at fair. And this guy is called Ozbot. And you can program him either by computer, iPad or so on.
OzBot. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Or by colors. I don't know if it's going to work because I didn't actually calibrate them in here in the light source, but we'll see if he does anything.
Oh, he's following the line?
So what he does is he follows the line. So we can do this by color. We get color pens. And each of these little dots in different colors is a different code.
And so it tells it to do something. Huh?
Yep.
It buzzes like a phone, too.
Yep, and it has motions. It can sense things and so on. Yeah. And
it's a little tiny R2-D2.
It is. Yeah.
That's R1-D1. Yeah.
It teaches coding skills. So there's proximity sensors in it, too.
So I would imagine that electrician would be a great volunteer to help with the robot.
Yeah. That's why we send Dave Hobbs, West Electric.
So the cool thing about this is it's not hard to learn so that people that are scared to death of doing robotics can learn to do this and teach kids and work with them.
Do you ever, this is horrible, but I got hooked on BattleBots.
Okay, no.
On television?
Yeah.
Holy cow. Some of the stuff they come up with, you go, now that isn't going to last more than a few minutes.
Yeah.
And it's killer at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, my kids like to do that stuff, but it's like, you know, guys, we've invested like $1,500 between the kids and the computers to do stuff. Do I really want them battling against each other?
Yeah.
No. So I'm trying to do things coordinated and they'll cooperate.
The cross-section of kids that are involved in that,
uh-huh.
You know, because it looks, how do I say this? Some of them look like, you know, they're the kid in the basement.
Yeah.
You know, playing on the internet.
Yeah.
And now you've got actually given them something that they can compete in on, that they're good at.
Yeah.
And it was it's just like you were saying. I'm a keen believer in being exposed to something and catching on just like that.
Yeah. And like you said,
I was on a bad path until I got into. I was exposed to air conditioning and refrigeration and heat transfer, the physics side of it, in the Navy. I knew exactly what I was going to do the rest of my life.
Uh-huh.
And I have been. Made a halfway decent career out of it.
Yeah.
But I had to be exposed to that.
Exactly.
I would have never gotten that exposure pounding the streets out here in a 56 Chevy. I'm going to guarantee you that.
Or running in the forest with a cable in your hand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
pulling
green chain out at Kback Field. It just, you have to be exposed to it. And I think that's where your program comes in.
Yeah.
You are going to expose them to numerous
things.
Until one guy goes, boy,
I really like that.
I'm in.
I want to be a politician.
Surprisingly enough, we did have one of those young men at, it wasn't from our county, but I met him who was up at Youth Voices in Action. And they work for some of the departments up there, and they're given questions that they then have to research and do a presentation on. And at the very end of it, he came to us and he goes, I'm going to go into political science. And he didn't even want to talk before that.
Poor kid. Give him my number.
Yeah.
I'll talk him out.
Yeah, we can talk him out of that.
I got a question for you. So
sure.
All three of us now have done the OSU Extension kind of presentation up at Corvallis through County College.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing all the other districts statewide and all the other programs going on. Do you think it's because the size of our district down here and just, I mean, obviously our rate is at a flat rate and it has been, and we're not in a high area that supports increasing rates.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, like, you know, the whole Coastal Caucus, you know, developed the WAVE program and,
mm-hmm.
and then they have engineering and different mm-hmm. parts and the farm to table, the schools and all that other kind of stuff. So, is it just because their districts are larger, they have more activity, or is it the fund base?
And funding. Funding does make a big difference in the, you know, what we can offer. There's only so much those of us can do, you know, and the more people that we have working, you know, the more things we can offer. There's a surf club on the coast, too, by the way, for 4-H. So that's another thing kids get exposed to.
They also have the Coastal Caucus, mm-hmm. which is really
yes.
powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't have a caucus down here.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that.
The tree caucus isn't as exciting.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Very good. So thank you, guys. And who's up next?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Sue.
Sure. Oh, and I did want to tell you the books I gave you. This is a report that goes out every year for the statewide 4-H program to kind of give you an idea of what's going on statewide with 4-H.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Sarah Runkle, and I am in the Horticulture Department, and I work here in Josephine County. My position is funded at 0.7, to provide horticulture programming to small farms and community horticulture audiences in Josephine County through the Extension Office. So my position, that 0.7, is split between a couple of different responsibilities. Let's see if I can figure out.
I'm wondering if you guys stand on this side, if it would have better access.
It's in this little box.
Can we push the box out the back side? Is that the side that the little thing is on?
Yeah, I was trying to turn it too.
Let me see if it is a better thing.
It's going to now go ahead 5.
2. Let me go grab it.
When it decides to go. Yeah, it doesn't look like it's
working
anymore.
Oh, it's this thing.
It's
here.
A little USB.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you advance it?
Why don't we just give you the eye sign and you can advance it
when
need be.
Until
you do that, Terry?
Yeah,
so.
Okay.
Where are we?
Just small farms, yeah. So I started my position in April of 2018. So I've been here about a year.
Oh, I don't feel so bad now because I can't ever get these things to work.
Let me try to put this out here and I'll give you the mouse.
Well, I think we're going to
try
some new
batteries.
Okay, here we go.
Step one.
If the batteries don't work, well, go to mouse.
There we go. At least the light is on now. That's an improvement.
Light's on.
Okay. That usually works.
I guess we have to get used to disappointment.
Technology.
Trish, it may just be you.
Can you advance? Can you just advance?
Yeah,
can you just right arrow it?
Yeah.
Just on the keyboard, just hit the right arrow.
It's not working.
We got no response.
Gosh, I broke it.
Now people are leaving.
This makes me feel so good.
Yeah, did the computer
just there for a while. I thought I was just.
Is the computer?
Bring it back up.
Hold on. No.
Reload.
So, in addition, I'll just give you a little bit of background. So, in addition to my 0.7 FD in Josephine County, I also do work statewide as part of the Oregon Farm Food Safety Team. So we have funding through the Oregon Department of Agriculture to work with produce growers, fruit and vegetable growers that are subject to the new Food Safety Modernization Act produce safety rule. So that is most of the other 0.3 of my time. And that requires a lot of. So I work with some growers here in Josephine County. We don't have a lot of big produce farms in Josephine County. We have a handful of growers that have larger orchards, and there's some blueberries and other produce growers.
Do you get involved in like the hemp industry?
I am not currently involved in the hemp industry.
Is OSU
although we
involved?
Get a lot of requests. I think Gordon is going to speak to that.
Oh, we got a lot.
I'll just let you know when I.
One?
Yeah.
Am I in the right one?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So a little bit about the small farms work that I do. So it's horticulture focused. So we have a lot of small farms in Josephine County. Actually, most of the small farms, when you look at the USDA classification of what a small farm is, that's $350,000 gross. Most of our farm businesses are technically small farms. We have a lot of producers that do direct marketing through the various farmers markets, farm stands, those sorts of things. So my focus is working with specialty crop producers, so fruit, vegetable, cut flowers, medicinal herbs. Those are the types of growers that I work with.
Lavender,
yep. So this past year I've been working with my colleague Maude Powell, who also serves small farms in Josephine County, and we're doing an agricultural needs assessment. So we've been interviewing other partner organizations and service providers to see, you know, what they do to serve small farms, if they've identified any needs, and talk to them about potential opportunities for collaboration, or if they've seen ways that Extension can support the growers that they work with. And then we're currently distributing a survey to actual producers and small acreage landowners. So we have a survey out to landowners to collect input on what their needs are. So some demographics about the types of agriculture that they're doing and how long they've been farming, and then what would help them be more successful as either small businesses or in managing their agricultural lands.
Is there much, through you, any networking as far as for transport? I was thinking about one farmer that, I mean, he, everything from the coast past Ashland, he's delivering blueberries and such. And so do they ever kind of reach out to you and say, hey, is there a networking of transport? So somebody else, I can take their stuff over. I'm going to the coast, I'll take their stuff that way. If they go to Ashland, take mine or something like that. Is that something you get find yourself?
So I haven't had any direct requests on that specific topic, but that's a good transition because we do a lot of work with networking. So one of the groups that I've been working with this past year is the cut flower farmer group. So we actually have a lot of small-scale cut flower producers that mostly sell locally, so at farmers markets to local florists. I had a couple of meetings in the fall with growers and now have 46 growers on my mailing list. And so these are people that are growing cut flowers commercially, and we are looking at ways to support that industry. So this is a cross county. It's Josephine and Jackson County growers because there's a lot of interest in this area with cut flower production. So we had meetings for growers, and then we also had a public event at the Josephine County office where we had four flower farmers bring flowers to the event and talk about their farms and supporting Oregon-grown cut flowers. And then the participants were able to make bouquets and take them home. And we had some really nice photographs hanging in our office for a couple of months.
Cause I think at the fair last year we went through a cut flower display, I guess,
there's a floral building.
In the floral building, and reptiles on one side, cut flowers on the other.
They go hand in hand.
Flowers was a very, very good, relaxing. You go to reptiles first, then you go to flowers, calm down, and back out into the fair.
Yeah, so the Grants Pass Garden Club coordinates that floral building, but we have master gardeners that provided some support in that building last year, and we've actually been talking to the commercial cut flower growers to see if they have flowers available that they would be willing to donate to the 4-H group when they do their flower arranging competition. So to get the 4-H members using local flowers and tie those groups together. So
I usually go in there to get ideas for colors for cars. Really, really pretty.
Yeah.
Some pretty stuff there.
So some of the other things I do in my small farms capacity is just providing technical assistance to people that walk in the door. So that's, you know, answering questions on the spot, whether it's people wanting to know how they can find someone to rent their land, or they're looking for land to rent, or they have a question about soil testing. And then also directing people to other either partner organizations or other faculty who may not be based in Josephine County but serve Josephine County that can help them. I also serve as the co-chair for the Blue Zones Food Policy Committee, and I have been working with the Grants Pass Growers Market. I did a presentation at their membership meeting in the fall, and I serve as the agriculture advisor for Raptor Creek Farm, which is the food bank farm. Yeah, go ahead. Community horticulture is a big part of my job, so most of this is coordinating the Master Gardener program. Part of community horticulture is providing general education to the community about gardening. So I gave a talk in Cave Junction to the garden club out there in the fall. I've done food safety and the edible garden presentations, and in 2018 we did 9 community education workshops at the Extension office on a variety of topics.
Curious if you are ever called upon to look at the soils or this challenging soils in relation to greenhouses and the amount of gravel being dropped into prime farmland?
That's a land use issue.
All right, so you stay away from that one. We're asked to regulate that. We've been asked to put restrictions on greenhouses, but up north, that's all you see in farmland.
Right.
So it's kind of a challenge to even look at that down here, but it is one that we've gotten a lot of pushback on.
It's a land, that's a LUBA question, right? Land use policy issue. So go ahead. So the Master Gardener program is a big part of my position. The person who held my position before Karen Pleasant, she was solely focused on community horticulture in the Master Gardener program. So the addition of the small farms is a little bit of a change to how that position was implemented in the past. So the Master Gardener program is a statewide program. We have Master Gardener programs in 28 of the Oregon counties. The Josephine County program is one of the oldest and one of the larger programs. And our goal with the volunteer program, as well as the community education that we do, is to make sure that we're offering reliable information. So the information that we provide to the community is science-based information, that it's relevant. So we want to meet people and provide information that will help them be better gardeners and better stewards of their environment. And then we're also reachable. So there are a variety of ways that the public can access resources through the Master Gardener program, whether it's becoming volunteers, coming to our plant clinic at the office, visiting with us at one of our community event booths, sending an email. We try to be as accessible as possible for the community. Go ahead. The Josephine County Master Gardener program is very active. The volunteers do a lot of different programs in our community. So one of our main goals is to provide technical assistance to gardeners. The Master Gardener program statewide has two focal areas. One is sustainable gardening, and the other is local and backyard food production. Our program also does a number of youth education programs, adult education, for volunteers to maintain their status as a certified Master Gardener. They need to do 20 hours of volunteer service every year and 10 hours of continuing education. So our program provides continuing education opportunities to volunteers. Of course, we're training and certifying new volunteers every year, and then we also do a lot of community outreach. Go ahead. In 2018, we had 238 volunteers, so that included everyone that was involved in the Master Gardener programs. We have a number of volunteers who provide indirect and support volunteer hours that are not certified, but they participate as Master Gardener volunteers. And then last year we had 98 who met that 10 hours of continuing education and 20 hours of volunteer service. We had 29 participants in the Master Gardener training class, and 26 followed through. So it's 70 hours of training and 70 hours of volunteer service that first year to become a certified Master Gardener volunteer. And they contributed over 10,000 hours of volunteer service and completed just over 2,000 hours of continuing education and over 7,500 direct public contacts. And I say over because, just like Sue, sometimes we have a hard time getting our volunteers to actually record everything that they do and give me all the data. So that's something that I've been working on with the volunteers for so that we can really demonstrate the impact of our program. Go ahead. So our technical assistance takes place in our plant clinic. So we have a plant clinic in the office year-round. We also staff a booth at the Grants Pass Growers Market in the summer on Saturdays. The Master Gardeners coordinate the horticulture building at the fair and have a plant clinic booth there. We do a number of community events, and then we also have volunteers who write articles for the paper and do a radio segment on KAJO every most weeks. And through our plant clinics, we answered 1,954 gardening questions from the community. Adult programming takes a variety of forms. So we offer Seed to Supper in partnership with the Food Bank, which is a free vegetable gardening class that we do in Grants Pass as well as in Cave Junction. Seeds of Spring is our annual community education mini conference. So it's a day-long event. People can choose four workshops to attend out of around 40 is what we typically offer every year. So there's a lot of opportunity for people to be engaged with all different sorts of gardening education. community education classes, we do outreach at events, and then we have a number of volunteers who are involved with the Oregon Bee Survey, which is a project that's a partnership with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and OSU, and they're actually going out into the field as citizen scientists and collecting bees and identifying them. And Southwest Oregon has some of the most diverse insect ecology in the state, and so our volunteers are doing some really interesting work with that program.
Has the city, I know that at various times the city's looked at banning gardening in your yard, and also bee houses, whatever you call the little hives, in the city limits, but I'm wondering if that's something that you ever keep a pulse on as far as offering the expertise of data and university level information. It might be worth reaching out to the city saying, if these topics come up, think of us.
Yeah, so that's definitely a role for Extension to play. And my understanding is that last year the city actually changed the zoning to allow for backyard beekeeping. And I haven't heard anything about the banning gardening, but I'll keep my ear out.
It wasn't recent. One point it was a discussion of whether or not the yards are too much unkept, of kind of nuisance kind of thing. But some communities have gone there, and a lot of the larger communities. I don't think Grants Pass is going to entertain that. But it is one of those things that I'm always curious about as people develop, you know, getting past the manicured grass to doing more things in the yard. And the only other thing I could think of is an outreach in the community, and maybe with the kids would be a partnership of more plants that are friendly to bees for the sake of pollination and expansive stuff.
So I'll get to that in a second, actually. Go ahead to the next slide. Our youth programming, our volunteers run the Young Master Gardener program at the Grants Pass branch of the Josephine County Library, and that's a 9-month program, so it's 1 day a month, and they do an activity for 5 and under, and then they do another activity for 6 and above, and that picture on the bottom left, so they actually bring in a big tarp to the youth room at the library and bring in soil, and that's a worm bin that the kids are digging through, and they have songs and read books, and it's a really engaging program. We also work in partnership with the 4-H program to offer the Junior Master Gardener program at Highland Elementary, and that's been a really great project. So our Master Gardener volunteers have become 4-H volunteers, and they're able to use their gardening knowledge to teach kids in this after-school program. And then we also provide a lot of support to school gardens in the city as well as in the county. So right now we have Master Gardeners actively involved in 5 school gardens, but we get requests, it seems like, almost every week for more support. So I'm working with Cheryl and some other community partners to figure out how we can most effectively serve this kind of growing need in our community in terms of school garden support. And there's a lot of interest. It's just who's going to maintain the garden.
I remember at Fruitdale Elementary, the program kind of waned because of summer. What do you do when school's out if the kids aren't maintaining it? And the neighbors weren't really. And then there was concern from the school of having neighbors coming on the school property during the school, you know, so that balance of.
Yeah, so Highland Elementary has a pretty successful model. So that garden is, there's one master gardener who serves as a mentor. And the PTA is very engaged. And in the summer, the parents actually take on management of the garden, and they run it as a community garden. So they have open garden night 2 nights a week, and then other families can come and work in the garden and take home produce. So that's one model we're looking at trying to expand to other gardens. Go ahead. We also have these lovely demonstration gardens that the Master Gardeners put in at our site, and this has been an ongoing project, so you've probably seen some of the in-progress pictures, but I definitely encourage you to come out to the office and see the gardens. I just took these pictures yesterday, the ones on the bottom, and so on the left-hand side, we have a demonstration of accessible and small-space herb and vegetable production. And then on the right-hand side is a demonstration of landscaping with pollinator friendly plants and native plants. And then we also have a small space fruit production demonstration. So we have 24 different varieties of grapes planted on the fence behind the office, as well as different types of apples and some small space fruit demonstrations as well. So we're working on signage for those gardens, and we'll be incorporating those gardens into the community education programs that we offer. Go ahead. I think that might be here. Oh, and then just a little bit about community partnerships and the importance of our relationship with the Josephine County Master Gardener Association, which is a separate nonprofit. So they raise money to support Master Gardener program activities. And in 2018, they raised almost $18,000 to support all of these programs that I just talked about. So they provide money to school gardens and help run the education programs. And then we also have a lot of other partnerships with community organizations. So the library, the food bank, garden clubs, RCC, the parks department. So we're really trying to cultivate this as a community program. That's it, I think.
This is the one that was hard for me not to cry through, because my grandma was involved with Master Gardeners before she died, and she just had a magnificent garden in her yard, and she passed. They rented the house out, and they trampled on her roses and everything else, and it's all gone. And so it just brought back all these memories of my grandma. So thank you.
Thanks.
I'm just amazed, though, that you guys have apples growing around the office.
We do, yeah, along the fence. So there's some columnar apples and espalier apples.
Wow.
And the grapes, too, are planted. There's like a strip.
You get 6 inches of...
Yeah. I'm going to break with tradition.
Please join us, yeah.
So I'm Karen Wheeler. I'm with Family and Community Health. My focus is really on public health and community development. Next slide. So my primary community, or my primary program areas, are the Master Food Preserver Program, the Strong Women Program, and then additional FCH efforts. Next slide. So the Master Food Preservers here in Josephine County, we have 18 volunteers who recertified this year. We are going to be holding our training again next year. So we balance between Jackson and Josephine County. So I serve in both counties. And so this year we're doing our volunteer training in Jackson County, and next year we'll be back in Grants Pass. So volunteers here in Josephine County provided over 716 hours of service. We tested 38 pressure gauges, and that assures that people are producing safe pressure canned products, so avoiding things like botulism and that sort of stuff. We connected with community members over 3,700 times. We do that through outreach events, Grants Pass and Kirby classes, and then also they have a large presence at the Josephine County Fair. They cover the home food preservation and baked good. Last year I helped with the pie judging. It's a lot of sugar.
Did you have to like keep peanuts in between or keep
keep the protein going? My eyeballs were vibrating by the end of it.
Has the Instapot revolution changed how this is doing too?
Yeah, so
you had to bring that up, didn't you? Bring that up later, could you?
I'm sorry. I got one, you know.
Strike an herb. Go ahead, Lily.
Okay, sorry. Keep going. So I don't know why that infographic didn't change. So we have the 2018 one. I can send that to you later. So the Instant Pot, what we found through a lot of our community food assessments is that people don't know how to cook. Like, at the very basic level, they don't know how to cook. So Instant Pot's been great because it gives people a new opportunity to start engaging with cooking. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, there's a lot of ways it doesn't actually save you time. but it's getting people excited about cooking. And so we actually have, we held a class last year on the Instant Pot, and we had one of our highest class turnouts because it really does get to the fact that people just don't know how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of fun to sort of work with community side by side, and the volunteers have been getting really excited about their multi-pots and stuff. But we do. We interact with people. We returned to the farmer's market last year. Kia McQuarrie, she's the new market manager out there. She's actually a former master food preserver, so we have a great ally there. We also have volunteers that are working with the food pantries doing cooking demonstrations and providing sort of that basic, here's a bunch of chard, what do you do with that now? You know, because we see that, you know, Raptor Creek's growing all this beautiful produce and people don't take it because they don't know what to do with it. So we've had that that relationship established, and they've been working through that as a volunteer opportunity. And then we also have a couple of very active volunteers out in the Illinois Valley who work with schools, who work with the food pantries out there, who are pretty much at every community event. So it's the berries, the prepare fair, the children's pet parade. So they're really interacting. And again, these hours are not indicative of what's actually happening, because one of my volunteers who's the most active is really bad about turning in her hours, and I can guarantee you she probably produced over 1,200 hours alone.
Just herself, yeah.
Yeah. 2 years ago, she actually was recognized by OSU for her volunteer efforts. Debbie Ashton, who worked with the Fruitdale Elementary School Garden. So we also oversee the Strong Women program, and so it's an evidence-based strength training program. It also focuses on fall prevention and osteoporosis mitigation and prevention.
How do women find out about that program?
So we have we've done some outreach through Facebook. We've done outreach in the Silver Pages. Just
Silver Pages?
Silver Pages is, yeah, it's part of the RV COGS ADRC stuff that they do.
That's 50 and up, and you're getting there.
Hey, I got 6 years, baby.
ARP.
I didn't mean to say that. I'm sorry. That was disrespectful.
But you missed.
No, what actually, just in reference, my grandmother resides with me, and she works out 4 days a week,
yeah.
And it's partially getting interaction with other people, but
mm-hmm.
keeping a routine,
yeah,
and different things, and so. But I've never heard of this program except when you guys come present here.
Yeah.
So that's just in the back of my mind. She goes to the Y. She does other stuff, but how do we get the word out about this to more people? Because RV COG isn't exactly something the general citizen,
yeah,
is.
And so it's something that we could be doing a better job of, you know, do some interviews with the paper and talk about it more. But, yeah, it's a cool program. And the women who have been engaged with it have been doing it together as a group for, like, 14 years. So it does really have that social support piece, too.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's probably, like, the foundation of all of the volunteer programs. That's really the nexus, is, like, that social network piece. And so this is a great program. We're also looking at bringing Better Bones in Balance, which is similar, but it's a little more strength training, and it's probably geared more towards post-retirement menopause age, where strong women tends to be an older demographic.
Got it.
So next slide, sorry. Yeah, so a major thrust of the work that I've been engaged with since I started in this position in 2016 has been the community health assessment and community health improvement plan, which is using a gold standard for community assessment, which is the Mobilizing for Action Through Planning and Partnership. So I'm on the core team for these efforts, and it's being held by the Jefferson Regional Health Alliance,
mm-hmm.
But the work has really been driven into the community. So myself, Belle Shepherd, Angela Warren, and Andrea Krause, who's the epidemiologist for Jackson County Public Health, we've been really holding this work together and moving it out. We did have our community health assessment, which was finalized in January 2019. It covers Jackson and Josephine counties. Partners are coming from all different sectors. We landed on our three priority focus areas in January, and so we started work groups to really dive into goals and strategies for what that would look like, connecting it to population health outcomes. And so the three focus areas are housing for all. It's essentially, they went through a couple of name changes, FRED, which was like family resiliency, education, and something like that. No. Now I think they've landed on families matter, really looking at family resiliency and connectedness. And so the third one that I've been the co-chair for, or the support person for the work group, is the housing for all work group. And so we've been, behavioral health, parenting and life skills, and then housing. And housing, we've really been looking at what are the two drivers of housing stress in our communities. So one of it is looking at, you know, stock availability and then affordability. And so our population outcome measure for that is the number of families that are paying, or is reducing the number of families paying in excess of 30% of their income on housing, because we know that when housing is destabilized, families experience higher levels of stress. Children have higher rates of absenteeism from school, family violence, chemical dependency, all these other things sort of ramp up as family stresses compound. And then the behavioral health one is inclusive of mental health and chemical dependency. So they're really focusing on the full complement of what that means. So they're talking about prevention, mitigation, and harm reduction. And so implementing a lot of different strategies. We've seen a lot of really impressive work done around prevention for youth suicide and risk behaviors, but we're also seeing high numbers of suicide, particularly gun-related suicides in the 45 and up white male population. And so looking at what strategies we can use for that community to really reduce some of the stigma attached with seeking services, and connecting people to community. So like the example that Sue gave with the young girl, right? Like there's lots of opportunities for that. As a public health expert, I come at it from looking at like what are the individual interventions, and then also how do we build a community where health and safety is the natural outcome. You know, and so that comes through policy systems and environment work. It's not all individual level services.
It is interesting. So what pops to my mind is community corrections. That's my background. Mm-hmm. But all of these are kind of wraparound services. And looking at how do we reduce future risk is getting those wraparound services early on. But both the juvenile justice in Josephine Jackson counties have residential programs. And an opportunity to engage with those programs, maybe to see about teaching those kids health, which it's not something they've ever been taught.
Yeah.
And then the adult system. I know that some of the things just at Community Corrections over here, they incorporated having snacks out in the morning. They get donated from either food bank or one of those, and they just put out fruit in the morning, some snacks and stuff like that. And the engagement of a healthy snack or a thought. But they, I know, let's see, Klamath County engages in the health clinic and mental health right in the department. And so mental health is engaged over here, but that case management side of, or that looking at overall health and hygiene, it'd be interesting to see. It's just a partner that I know that's not but it's a level of probably the highest risk population,
yeah,
which probably can get incorporated in any of those. Most of them are probably engaged in one of those other ones as well.
Well, and so the listed partners here are all members of the steering committee.
Mm-hmm.
And so the steering committee is really driving the connections into some of those work group areas. And so for our work group, we had people from housing, we had people from city planning, we had land use planning, we had, you know, people who were working with homeless case management, we had people who were working as builders and developers. You know, so it's using the contacts of these folks to really engage a broader audience. And so we're getting to the point, because the CCOs have to have their community health improvement plans in a final draft form for their internal review process by June 1st. And so we've laid out sort of a path forward, and it does sort of fold in those sort of different populations and risk levels and how we start to pull them into the conversation towards health. But those work groups will be opening up much larger to engage even broader audiences starting in the fall. But we'll be doing presentations across the region, just getting people to understand where we've been and where we're going, mm-hmm. you know? And that's part of why we've adopted this sort of all-in for health, because it really is going to take a different mix of partners to get at some of these root causes, you know, because it's a lot of these wraparound services, which are band-aids on symptoms of a bigger issue. So how do we get there? And I've been really impressed because I was part of the process when we did this in 2013 with just the CCOs. I was the public health accreditation coordinator for Jackson County. And so to see the transition from where we were then to now, like, the buy-in is so much bigger this time. And I think it's really impressive, and I think we have a lot of opportunities. The community health assessment is really depressing, right? Like, it's a lot of data, like, you know, recidivism rates, crime rates, opioid, you know, educational outcomes, absenteeism, health disparities, all sorts of stuff. But the chip is really where we find that optimism and really how to change that entire framework. And I think we have a lot of momentum, and people are really hungry for this sort of cross-system collaboration that we haven't seen before. So,
what about veterans and engaging veterans? I mean, even one of the things you said is getting people just to identify with this, and we've learned this from our veteran service officer that at RCC, for instance, if you ask if they're a veteran, women don't say yes, but if you ask if they've served, they will mark that they've served, but they won't identify as veterans.
That's right.
And so getting them connected to services is challenging, but that would be because we're also looking at 22 suicides a day with veterans. You know, various risk coordination. We have a high suicide rate in youth in our community for some reason, and so, like you said, the engagement level, but trying to find a way to I don't know if you ever have an opportunity to do reach out to our veteran service offices in the two counties as far as
so the VA is part of these work groups as well.
Yeah, but the VA, well...
So the Veteran Service Officers...
Different.
Okay.
Those are county offices that really are trying to engage and find people that are veterans to get them engaged in the services there.
Okay.
But I find people don't like to go to the VA unless, well, I got to go to my doctor's appointment or I got to do this and that. But otherwise, it's just a...
Yeah, so they have the Veteran Services at Jackson County Public Health. Is it housed in public health here?
No, ours is downstairs.
Okay, okay, yeah.
But just another thought of another opportunity of a group.
Yeah. No, that is an important one to capture. And I think, you know, as far as youth suicides, I often think of that as sort of like your canary in the coal mine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's symptomatic of bigger issues. And, you know, we do see high rates of chronic absenteeism in kids in Grants Pass in the Josephine County School District. And so we know there's high family, there's high intergenerational poverty rates in this community. And so how do we mitigate some of those stresses, and how do we design a system that supports not just mitigation, but also moving out of,
mm-hmm.
like, paths out of poverty? And so I think we're looking at, that was one of the tenets that the Jefferson Regional Health Alliance really tasked the steering committee and all of the work groups with, right? So we looked at housing, behavioral health, and families, but really understanding that poverty is one of the driving factors for all three of those.
Well, did you see the, was it the Oregon... OPB or Oregonian both put out the report of the 20 poorest zip codes in Oregon, and five of the top six are Josephine County, including number one.
Yeah.
So we just didn't have two. We had one, three, four, five, six, of which four of the five were in the Illinois Valley.
Yeah.
Wolf Creek was the other one. But we found that when we were looking at putting, our economic development director had suggested putting sidewalks in Merlin that would, with industrial lands and businesses that we lands that we have, as businesses came and looked, they were kind of deterred. And so they thought that by putting sidewalks in, businesses would be more likely to say, no, I want to invest in this community, we actually heard from some in the community, we didn't ask you to bring business here. We don't want to change. And it's like, how do you counter generational poverty when there is a desire to stay out, you know, keep out of my business?
Well, and I think that's part of, you know, what Sue talked about was that spark. So, you know, engage in community early in the conversation. And that's really the value of the MAP process, is that it is a community-driven assessment process. And so you are at every turn engaging community in the conversation about, you know, like, I have all the data, and I can be like, this is what we need to focus on. And then they're like, well, I could care less about sidewalks. What I really care about is the fact that, you know, my kid doesn't have, you know, food every day. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that tells me that I need to start with something that they care about mm-hmm. before I even try to get them to see what I'm seeing, because it's hard to focus on these bigger issues when you're not even able to make basic needs.
So yeah. True.
So yeah. I think that's the last of my slides. No? Mm-mm. Yeah. So community outreach and engagement. So these are sort of the ways that I am integrating into other areas outside of this one. So I'm the chair for the Southern Oregon Health Equity Data and Sustainability Work Group. So that covers Jackson and Josephine counties. I'm also the Region 2 representative for the Oregon Public Health Association. So it's Jackson, Josephine, Douglas, Coos, Curry, and Lane, I believe. And then upstream public health. Their focus is really on tobacco prevention and obesity prevention. So they started a group, it's Healthy Active Oregon. It's the first ever statewide obesity coalition. So we're really excited to see the work that's going to come out of that group. Also part of the Barriers to Healthy Eating Work Group for the Rogue Valley Food System Network. Caring Community out in the Illinois Valley. It's predominantly looking at like young children and families. And then the Oregon Community Food System Network, looking at the VeggieRx program and how we connect people to resources that get them fresh produce. And right now we have a statewide evaluation going on for that. I believe 6 communities are implementing that, and so I've helped design that evaluation, and we're excited to see what comes out of it. So I think that's okay. Any questions?
No, but thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning.
Hey, Cheryl.
Hi. I think I'll sit down. Boy, it's kind of dim, the light in here.
Oh, I was taking the reflection off of the screen for
okay,
us.
Okay, that's all right. That's all right. I can see. Okay, well.
And just for you, both of your knowledge, Cheryl's also one of our Board of Health members.
Okay, thank you.
And I think I have that on my slide. So I have been, that's okay, I have been with Extension since 2012, and I've lived in Josephine County since 1997. I'm a registered dietitian, worked for the hospital, and also taught a class for RCC prior to coming to Extension. So go ahead and we'll switch the slides. One of my key programs is our OSU Nutrition Education Program. And I work in both Jackson and Josephine counties. So, you know, on paper, my time is split 50-50 between each county. And then I'm split 50-50 between overseeing our SNAP-Ed and FNET programs and then other FCH programs. So the two photos down here are the two staff members that I have in Josephine County. So we have Chandra Disraeli, who started with us in 2017 in about September and relocated from Santa Barbara to come to Grants Pass because she wanted better quality of life for her young child. And then Ann Gross, who has been working for, she's been here for 5 years and is a certified teacher. So the SNAP-Ed program, and Sue was talking about program years, we are a federally funded program through the Farm Bill. And our charge is to provide nutrition education and education, directing people towards more physical activity for populations that are SNAP eligible. So this program in Oregon, the funding comes to DHS, and then it's distributed among all 36 counties through OSU Extension is how the program's administered. And in our county, my two employees are 1.35 FTE, and they're all grant funded with support, you know, from our office staff or some of our other things that we do.
How much money enters the state, and then how much money actually goes to your program at Jackson Josephine?
My programs in Jackson Josephine are, I wrote that down today, here we go. In Josephine County, my grant funding for the program is about $160,000. And in Jackson County, I have, the total is about 300. I think I have about $187,000 in Jackson County per
year. How much money enters the state of Oregon?
There is several, like $7 million in the state of Oregon. And we have some of the things that we do are supported at the campus level. So that's why I brought some of these materials to you. So we do have, we have county teams and we have a state team. And, you know, I believe we accomplish a great amount of work at the local level, and then we have pretty good support at our state level. One of the key, we can click through the slides here. You can, if you go back, it shows the number of contacts we had. It was like 7,600. That's individual contacts, so that's not repeated. That's from our civil rights reporting. Let's see, go back one more. Oop, okay. Go ahead and go forward. I didn't remember what order I have things in. So our work is all done. We don't have people come to us very often. We go to all of the places in the community that we work. So you can see we work with Head Start, Early Head Start, Boys and Girls Club. Siskiyou Community Health Center has an outreach program in both Grants Pass, Medford, and Cave Junction. So we do programming with those folks. We work with the WIC programs. We do a lot of work with the food bank and Raptor Creek Farm. The food pantry program that Karen referred to is working using our SNAP Ed materials and resources. Work with YMCA Kids Zone, both school districts, school food service, Blue Zones Project. This last summer, between Sarah and I, we were instrumental in helping with the double up food bucks at the growers market.
Is that getting renewed?
It is. Yep. Okay. I helped Kia write some proposals, and she has funding for this year.
Okay.
There's also a legislative proposal right now for some state funding, and if we get state funding, there's matching federal funds.
Okay.
So it's proved to be a really a nice streamlined program for getting more dollars for local produce and more dollars in the hands of the SNAP customer as well as the local farmers. So it really does double the money for both of those people with the single dollars. We also do a lot of work with our CCOs, All Care and Primary Health. And last year we expanded and did some programs at the Illinois Valley Senior Center and with Food and Friends. And I can see that we'll have some opportunities once, this sounds kind of weird, but once Food and Friends moves out of our building and they're able to expand to doing more than distributing meals, we can probably have some program impacts there.
Yeah, they're looking for definite partnerships and programs.
Right, yeah. And Sarah and I are, she's looking at doing some garden, what are we going to call it, an assessment of a garden facility at the new location.
Is there a lot of space behind the building to the back of the property? That'd be awesome.
There's, I was out there on Friday. They have a nice
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Check with the city to make sure they don't, that they allow gardens.
Well, we have a phone call with the city, too, as soon as we're done here. So, so anyway, our work is encompassed in working through all of these partnerships. We have MOUs, and we set a plan of work each year to try and reach out in all these different areas. Let me go ahead and flip. And so that involves things like what Karen was talking about, policy systems and environment change. We developed this healthy school celebration concept, and this is just kind of a fun project we did this spring. This is a dietetic intern that I had with me for 3 weeks. And we've done this Healthy Celebrations training where we've talked to teachers about how they can do parties in the classroom with something other than soda and ice cream and pizza. And the school district...
That's the three basic food groups.
Right. The school district, I met with the food service director. I said, do you guys have any old AV carts? And I went over to District 7 and Michael Morris and I dug through some sheds. I mean, it was a rainy day like this. He basically opened sheds and we found these old VCR carts, you know, that were taller than this. He said, oh, yeah, yeah, I'll dig them out and I'll have our facilities guys cut them off. 2 days later, I had these raw carts delivered to me. So I had my intern revamp these into a smoothie cart.
Nice.
And we're going to dig out more and recycle these and put them into the schools. So we've taken these to Redwood and Parkside Elementary has gotten these this year. So we'll see how this little concept goes. But it was kind of fun. A good experience for the intern. Encouraging non-food rewards in the schools is one of the things we're aiming to do. And a lot of this work overlaps real well with some of the things we've been seeing in the Blue Zones project. So one of the most valuable things that I think has come from that is getting people kind of on the same page and to the point where we're taking some of the policy that is out there, like schools have wellness policy that they are supposed to be implementing. That policy's been sitting on the shelf in the district office, but we're seeing things like this happening now where that policy's actually getting put into practice to a greater extent. So we can go ahead and move forward. This is just another slide with our involvement with Josephine County Food Bank and Raptor Creek Farm. So the food pantry project was started in 2017. And what's been really valuable about that is, you know, my staff, that 1.35 FTE, if we got to the food pantries, we got there in the summer, and we got there once or twice throughout the summer. But what we've been able to do with the volunteers is they are going three times a month, to three pantries per month every month. And they are providing food samples based on using our OSU Food Hero newsletters that come from our campus office out of part of that big chunk of money that OSU gets, and providing those food demos. The food bank out in Illinois Valley, there has only been one food pantry that's operating, and the needs are really great out there. So they have started a pop-up pantry that's happening four times a month in Selma right now. They're operating out of that old Selma
It's Three Rivers School District owns it.
Yeah, so they're kind of looking for a permanent pantry and something out there, but I was out there, I sent that same intern out there a couple of times, and working with the food bank volunteer coordinator to do some food demos out there as well. That's a really interesting situation, so they're really hoping to try and establish a permanent location because there's so much need out in that community. And there's just the one pantry in Cave Junction that has a few issues interacting with the community. and then what we've done with planting the seeds for the future is the program that we have done with YMCA and Boys and Girls Club. And we've also received support for doing this program from All Care because the children are bused out to Raptor Creek Farm and they do an education program once a week throughout the summer. So my educators participate in that program. And it's really fun. I mean, there's a gazebo built at the farm. And
my grandson's already talking about it.
Yes, okay.
Do we get to go this year?
Yeah, so it'll be happening. Yep. It's a lot of fun. I mean, it, unfortunately, we had a lot of smoke days last year, and they had to, but they...
We actually passed an ordinance to have no smoke days this
year. All right, good.
So, yeah.
I'm all for that.
We have relief for at least 1 year.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great?
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. I think that they are already planning if they have to be indoors to be indoors. So, and, you know, the food bank has some pretty consistent staffing right now in those positions. Over the years, we've seen there's been a different education coordinator each summer and farm manager, but I think those positions are stabilizing
a little
bit.
Having the local the authority of it. I think having it brought back local management
out of
UCAN.
Yes. So, you know, it really, we have a really great resource at Raptor Creek. That's a very unique setting for the food bank and having the farm and then having all that city land across the road with potential.
Is the 555,000 pounds of produce come out of only Raptor Creek?
No, I don't believe so. Do you know, have any numbers on what comes out of Raptor Creek?
I think they're between 30 and 40,000 pounds of produce, but I've been working with their farm manager to actually look at servings that are produced by the farm, not necessarily weight, because a serving of watermelon weighs a lot more than a serving of lettuce, and so the farm is trying to provide more diversity with the types of produce.
Well, I just wonder where all that food comes from. If only, what did you say comes out of Raptor Creek?
I think it's between 30 and 40,000 pounds.
Where's the rest of it?
Well, they are part of a Fresh Alliance. They get some produce from grocery stores. They get some produce from the Oregon Food Bank. So the Josephine County Food Bank is a warehouse, is basically how the food bank works, is they are a warehouse for all of the pantries and the other agencies that they serve. So, you know, some of that comes from, you know, stores that ready to expire.
Just produce. In other words, the food bank has a lot of canned goods and...
Oh, yes, absolutely. Stuff,
but just produce, they had over 555,000 pounds?
That they distributed.
It's almost unbelievable in my mind. Yeah. I can't get my hands around, arms around that much produce.
Okay, well, they're serving about
a few days.
They're serving 10,000, close to 10,000 people each month.
Wow. Well, and unfortunately, I mean, we've seen out here where on food pantry days you'll see whole bags of beans or rice or something else just in our trash can outside the elevator out here. And it was one of the issues that the Rock Food Pantry was dealing with, is people, as they're walking away, they're tossing things out. So that's when they switched to the model of
a shopping.
So you only take what you actually will use.
Right.
But they, I mean, how many people that go there don't actually have the capability of cooking or eating
absolutely
healthy?
Yeah. And one of the interesting things this year is the food banks across the nation ended up with cans of pork because of the tariffs, and the sale of pork was down with trade. And so there are these cans of sort of generic-looking canned pork. And I had that intern of mine do the food demo out in Selma using that pork and made burritos out of it to show people what to do with what is actually available. So it's pretty interesting what kind of food runs through. They also got a ton of apples. They got oodles and oodles of apples because they were not able to internationally market the apples as well this year. So there was a huge amount of apples in the food bank system. Fortunately, they keep for a long time.
Yeah.
So they were able to, you know, keep those and distribute
them. How do apples keep for a long time? We had apples trees when I grew up, and they don't last very long.
How they're grown these days.
If you store them, an apple stores quite... I mean, that's why we have apples in the grocery store pretty much year-round, is they store better than, you know, strawberries or raspberries or something like that. So
the gas-ripened apples in the store, primarily.
Well, these apples that are
the question,
the food bank system are commercially grown produce, so
okay,
they would be similarly... Okay.
Well, I'm always amazed how Harry and David can send you a really nice pear in February.
Yeah.
It's like, where did that come from? The big warehouse.
Yeah. Well, and pears are picked. Pears are not picked ripe. I mean, they're picked to ripen over time. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. So again, you know, I interact with a lot of coalition groups as well, and some of those that Karen mentioned, but I'm currently on the board for the Josephine County Food Bank, which is, it's been really interesting because they have transitioned away from UCAN, and, you know, they were in a mode where fundraising was the key thing for a lot of years to build the facilities that are out there right now. And so now we're kind of entering a point where I feel like my role is... more on outreach and awareness of what needs exist in our community and how we can address those in sustainable ways. I've been a member of the Josephine County Board of Health. I just cycled off of that group just because I joined on to the food bank. I've participated with Southern Oregon Head Start Health Advisory Committee for a long, long time. And that committee just meets twice a year, once in Josephine County and once in Jackson County. But it is a really good group that talks about a lot of programming that's going on with families of young children, and then there's a lot of crossover in work we can do together. Grants Pass School District Wellness Committee, and this morning I just came from the Blue Zones steering committee meeting where we're talking about, you know, what are we going to do after year three of the Blue Zones, how are we going to move forward. Some of the thought there is looking at the chip and the chaw that Karen was talking about, identifying what are the key priorities, how do we move forward with what organizations are able to do in our community, and what we want to collectively do, and how we move that model forward. Because I think there's a lot of positives that have come out. There's a lot of other parts that are challenging with that project. I've also worked with the Restaurant Grocery Committee and then interfacing with that Food Policy Committee of the Blue Zones, where we have a lot of really good ideas brewing, and I think they would happen regardless of Blue Zones, but it's been a good way to pull a lot of those folks together. And the other piece, I think I have one more slide. So this is kind of what I want to wrap up with, is that, you know, all of the work that we do in family and community health and small farms and extension is really looking at the opportunities that we have to collectively build on community assets, addressing the challenges, and doing what we can to improve the places where we live, work, and play. So that's what we're aiming to do. And some of that happens through economic development and, you know, working in partnership. Okay. Any questions or?
No.
Yes.
Don't think so.
Okay.
Thank you.
So who's going to speak for you'll take a swing at it.
Gordon, you can chime in.
Okay.
Maud can't be here today, but we work together on some programming, so this will probably be pretty short. But these are slides that she put together. So Maud is funded at 0.5 FTE, and that's state funding. And then she is really good at writing grants. So she currently has a grant right now that I'll talk about in a couple slides to run a veteran farmer training project. So that's Sebastian's position is funded through that grant. She also brings in a program income and additional grant funding for Paula, who's a part-time assistant, and then she contracts with another educator to do a number of workshops for her clients. Go ahead. So the Growing Veteran Agripreneurs, Maud has run an agripreneurs program at SORAC, which is the Jackson County Research and Extension Center, for a number of years. This year, the focus of the program is on training veterans who are interested in growing vegetables. So it's a combination of classes that they do at the farm, and then also partnership with Rural Farm Corps. They do farm tours, and then the participants work on the farm, the teaching farm that's at SORAC. And so they've done outreach with veteran services offices, both in Josephine and Jackson counties. And right now they have 8 veterans participating in the program. Go ahead. Angie Boudreau does a lot of these livestock and forages classes. That's her area of expertise. So these are offered mostly in Jackson County, but Maud has a pretty extensive mailing list that includes small farms in both Josephine and Jackson County. So a lot of people travel to Jackson County to take these classes. So you can see there's a wide range of classes that she offers related to livestock and forages. Go ahead.
Do you know if the animal control officers in Josephine and Jackson County are ever reached out to about taking part in some of these classes to make sure they're current on knowledge on those?
I don't know, but that's a great idea. We should get them on our mailing list.
It would be great. I know that they investigate neglect of horses in mud, so that one stood out to me as a goodness, if we're doing teaching, we should make sure they have all the information.
Yeah, I know when I worked in Douglas County, I did a presentation to the
animal control officer and his volunteers that he managed. Maud also coordinates the League of Women Farmers, which is a women farmer network for Southern Oregon. And I'm not sure on the exact number of participants in that network, but they do retreats and farm tours around the two counties. Go ahead. One of Maud's focuses is seed education. So seed production for specialty crops is kind of a niche agricultural opportunity for producers in Josephine and Jackson counties. So she facilitated the formation of the Southern Oregon Seed Growers Association, which holds meetings and is a network of seed producers in the area. And the teaching farm at Sorek has in the past served as a seed teaching farm, so they've done education around how to actually grow specialty crops for seed production and then how to get a contract with a seed company to sell that product. Go ahead. And then other classes that she offers. So Maud coordinates a large pesticide recertification event for which serves both counties, and I think she has over 100 licensed pesticide applicators participate in that event. So that's an essential service that is provided through Extension to make sure that our licensed pesticide applicators stay current with their education requirements. And then other kind of a variety of topics. So the Small Farms Program encompasses a lot of different types of farming, and so we try to do outreach and programming to meet a variety of needs. And I don't know if there's any more slides. Go ahead. That's the last one. Okay. Anything else?
Wait, pinch it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're talking about somebody else's program.
He goes,
thank you, Sarah.
There goes Maud's 0.4 FTP.
Maud does a lot of work with halftime position.
Well, he's choosing to stand.
Standing.
All right.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be here. My name is Max Bennett, and I run the Extension Forestry and Natural Resources Program. So I'm a faculty member with the College of Forestry at OSU, and I'm based down here. This is my 20th year serving Jackson and Josephine counties. So I work in these two counties and work with colleagues around the state and some other initiatives. If we can just back up, I do want to mention Tara Balog is my colleague, and she also works on forestry and natural resource stuff, mostly around fire and also some youth education programs. She's entirely grant-funded, and she is at three-quarter time. Okay, so moving on. So you can just hit the first button here. So some of the issues that we deal with. A lot of my focus is on working with people who live out in the country, in the wild and urban interface, small woodland owners, of which there are many thousands in Jackson and Josephine counties, a couple hundred thousand plus acres of forest land. So like if you look at that map right behind you there, you see a lot of Forest Service, a lot of BLM, but there's a lot of private land in the two counties, and a lot of private land that's just owned by families and individuals. And that historically has been a big part of my focus, helping those folks manage their forest lands for all of the benefits that they provide, economic, timber harvest, social, and environmental.
How do you get connected with those people?
I work with the Jackson Josephine Small Woodlands Association. We send out mailings to people in the communities, just networking.
Do you do anything with ODF?
Yeah, quite a bit, as I'll explain here in a minute. So how could we not start with wildfire, since this is obviously a kind of a front and center issue with everyone these days, you know, ranging from the smoke to the risk to communities, and you all know how at risk Josephine County is. You probably saw that risk assessment that showed the, you know,
number one and two are
number one and two. All right. So a lot of work to do out there. But the good news about it is there's a lot that individual landowners and homeowners can actually do to improve their survivability of a home in a fire. This is an example. I knew this gentleman And they did a lot of good work and survived the Squire fire in 2002. So that's a local example. So that's one issue that we focus on a lot. Next one, please. Another one is forest health. And we've had a lot of drought stress, a lot of dead and dying trees. That's in Ferris Gulch here in Josephine County. So just a tremendous number of issues. And a lot of the issues around fire and forest health all have to do with having overgrown forests. As I say, too many straws in the coconut, too much density, too much brush, really flammable, and so that leads to these fire and forest health issues. So that's a lot of what we
have. Is that beetle kill,
yep.
Insect kill, rather than just, you say, drought and
well, it's,
slide and shock and all that other stuff?
It's both.
My third grade science said that like a conifer like that, it'll sink a taproot down until it finds water. Doesn't care whether it's on the surface or not. It's not really a water issue with them, with a conifer.
Well, I would say
more a beetle kill than
yeah, it is. And actually, those a lot of those trees were killed by an insect called the flat-headed fir borer, which is kind of like a bark beetle. Probably mm-hmm. heard of bark beetles, but the evidence shows pretty strongly that when we have drought periods and when we have forests that are too dense, that they're much more susceptible to this guy. So I think it's a combination. Of drought stress, too dense, overstocking, as we say, a bunch of factors. Okay, next one, please. And then another issue, and again, this is thinking about working with the small woodland owner audience. We have a lot of new folks coming to Jackson and Josephine counties from California or wherever. They're buying rural property. They want to live the Southern Oregon rural dream. And so a lot of what we do is reach out to those folks and try to help them understand the environment they're living in and how to take care of it. So.
I'll never forget some folks moved up from the Aurora Grande area outside of San Luis Obispo, and they couldn't wait to come to Southern Oregon and plant some blackberry.
Whoa!
What do you...
Good educational opportunity right there.
How do you get... Yeah, they'll learn.
Yeah.
A couple years, they'll know all about it.
Yeah.
But we get the new folks that want to move here and buy some property.
Yep.
And then they go out there with an 8 and they cut down everything and plant marijuana. We have numerous complaints about why I can't do anything with the trees on my property without the county breathing down my neck or the state breathing down my neck or the city breathing down my neck. But yeah, here comes a grower and he just gets in there with an 8, pushes it all right to the property line, creating a fire hazard right at the property line, which threatens everybody else, and we don't do a darn thing about it. Why?
About
clearing just
for marijuana groves?
Well, clearing, cutting down what we are calling, we need to preserve forest health. That isn't forest health. And we don't do anything about that at all. There's no rules governing that. There is, but no enforcement governing that.
Yeah, there's an Oregon Forest Practices Act that, you know, mm-hmm. that requires replanting of areas that are cut. But you can also apply for a land use conversion, and I don't know how that works. So that's another one of those land use issues.
Okay.
So let's see. Next one, please.
Just curious, new owners, are you engaged with Rogue Valley Association of Realtors or anybody else as far as...
We have done some outreach to realtors, sometimes the title companies, sometimes with the Realtors Association.
If you sell this property, please contact me. Yeah.
Right. And we found actually one of the most effective ways to reach out is simply to talk with the assessor, get a list of who's purchased land, and reach out to those folks directly. Mm-hmm. That's proven to be pretty effective. So this program called My Southern Oregon Woodlands is just to do exactly with this audience that owns woodlands. And what we're trying to do with this program is help people take care of their land so it's not such a fire risk and so it's healthier and not such a well-managed and not such a liability. And so this is a grant-funded program. It's a partnership with ODF, Oregon Department of Forestry, OFRI, that's Oregon Forest Resources Institute, based up in Portland. American Forest Foundation, that's a national organization that is helping to fund this, and some other partners. And so we do this via mailings, some social media, Facebook ads. And what we provide to folks is forester visits. So through this process, you can get a visit from an ODF forester. We have a network of volunteers called the Woodland Neighbor Network, which are just some volunteers that I've trained that are woodland owners. They have a lot of experience, and they like to visit other landowners, so it's kind of like a peer network. So they go out and do some visits. We host some community meetings. For example, you know, come to this meeting to learn about defensible space funding, fire funding in your area. And so, and what we try to do is get folks enrolled in some of the available assistance programs when they're available. So, like, if you live out in Merlin and there's a defensible space grant to get you signed up to that program so that you can have somebody come out on your property, write up a prescription, and maybe get a rebate.
So who's these grants going to, defensible space grants? Is that ODF?
ODF administers it, and typically that's, you know, there's various grants that are available in different areas, and it changes all the time. You know, one grant runs out, and so there's another grant. But ODF mostly gets the grants, and they administer.
And then we as a county also use our Title III dollars to contract with ODF for fireways.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fireways coordinator for our county is paid through our dollars.
Oh, yeah.
We've budgeted for a second fireways coordinator going into this next year, as well as a planned implementer for our CWPP, or Coordinator Wildland Protection Plan.
Community Wildfire Protection
Plan,
CWPP.
I change the name of it every time I try to remember what CWPP stands for. But we're using Title III dollars to try to get the plan implemented with a two-county process. Not sure if Jackson County's on board yet, but we're at least trying.
Yeah, great. Yeah, and I think FireWise is another program we're connected with. Tyler, the local ODF FireWise coordinator, we work with him on this program, and it's also an opportunity to advertise FireWise, come to a community meeting, learn about the potential through FireWise. So just wrote down some data here really quickly. In 2018, right here, we engaged 216 landowners, 80 site visits, 14 new stewardship plans, 39 sign-ups for cost-share programs, and affecting about 8,500 acres of forest land. So I think pretty good impact through this program.
What do you put on Facebook? Generally just do you do videos? Do you just do...
It's more like an advertisement for a notice about an upcoming, you know, meeting or opportunity in their area.
I just want to make sure that we get you connected with ours. And, I mean, the potential of, even if we could do a short video and put it on our website, or connection of your program, we can advertise on our website and also our Facebook pages, just to make sure. This is probably the number one thing I'm contacted about, is what are you doing as a county to help us be fire safe? What are you doing? Blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, what are you doing as a property owner? How are you creating your defensible space on your property?
Right.
You neighbor BLM. What are you doing as far as, you know, what they allow you to do
100 feet into
their,
right,
you know.
Yep.
But then you got to drag it back, you know. And,
yeah.
So it's like.
And then you can't burn it because it's an overburned.
It's an overburned, yeah.
Yeah.
plenty of hurdles, but I got you. So one, you just need to, we all need to be as well connected.
Well, and that, but the opportunity of us to have a connection on our, you know, if people are coming to the county, what are you doing, county? Well, here, look at this program, you know, for property owner stuff. So.
Yeah, great. Next one, please. So another program very much in this vein, but a little more general, is called Land Stewards. And, you know, just imagine you've come to Southern Oregon, you just bought 20 acres, you're out in the Applegate or in Murphy or something, and you're kind of interested in taking care of your property, but you don't know exactly what to do. So this is the perfect program for you. It's called Land Stewards. Deals with soil. You can see the list of topics: soils, pasture, woodland, wildlife. It's kind of an exposure to all of those topics. And we have a couple of different models of this. One that is in Jackson County that's pretty much of a field-based program, but this year we developed what we call a hybrid model, which includes some online instruction, two Saturday field trips, and one classroom session. And so this is kind of a pilot program. I taught that this year in Josephine County, 18 participants. Mostly Josephine County, although we had a couple of folks come down from the Salem area, interestingly enough, and one person from Brookings. They just wanted to learn about it and feel like it was a really successful program. They all said they'd recommend it to other landowners. So we want to continue to do this and expand it. We also have a Living on Your Land conference that we just did on April 27th here at RCC, and it's similar to the Seeds of Spring program that you heard about. It's kind of a mini college. We have a lot of different classes on kind of rural living topics, and I've listed just some of the more small woodlandsy sorts of topics that were part of that conference. Next one, please. And just some other classes. These are offered in conjunction with the Small Woodlands Association, with ODF. You know, we pretty much partner with just about all the programs that we do. This particular example, we try to do a lot of field-based stuff and make it really practical. So this is out in the woods. One of my volunteers talking about equipment and personal wearing your chaps and, you know, how to work safely in the woods. That's just one rotation in this workshop that covers things like pile burning or thinning, a number of topics related to home fire protection. So next one, please. So kind of on a totally different scale, I've talked a lot about direct work with landowners, trying to educate them and get them connected with cost share programs. This is another initiative that OSU Extension is part of. It's called the Rural Forest Restoration Initiative. And this is a partnership involving the Southern Oregon Forest Restoration Collaborative, Nature Conservancy, ODF, Forest Service, BLM, OSU, I think I'm forgetting one partner, that basically got together to apply for this big grant from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to fund forest restoration and fuels reduction activity in some selected areas in Southern Oregon. It's called the Focused Investment Partnership Grant, and so we were fortunate to be awarded that. It's $6 million over three biennia, so it's like $2 million per biennium. And you know, again, the intent is to do work and some focused some forest work on federal land and also on some adjacent private lands. Mostly on federal land, about 5,000 acres, about 1,000 acres on private land. And right now, the focal areas in Josephine County, Williams, because Natural Resource Conservation Service is also working out there, so we're trying to do kind of a joint thing where we can really get some, you know, accomplish a lot in that area. And also Briggs, which is a Forest Service project that's west of town here.
So I know there's a lot of push for the good neighbor, the stewardship projects and stuff, and the ONC Association has kind of been iffy on those because 25% of U.S. Forest Service or 50% of BLM harvest goes back to the county. And so far, these projects, though they are creating the restoration of the forest and stuff, they are utilizing county roads to get there, causing damage and utilizing resources, but not funding back into restoring those things. And so that's one of the things that we've been talking about, that partnership of how do we do the work that needs to be done while funding the infrastructure that needs to be done to keep it going kind of stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for example, I think Briggs is going to include a mix of, I know, at least some traditional timber sales that will, you know, return revenues to the county. I don't know how much stewardship is part of that particular one.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, and there's some of the forests, like I did a tour last week in the Colville National Forest up in
Northeast Washington. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And their stewardship project, they were able to turn around and reinvest $12 million into the county roads, and they redid the bridges and culverts on the county roads. So instead of them giving money to the county, they did the project, which essentially is the same thing as far as... So trying to look at creative ways of those partnerships with the federal agencies and local level to not have it be a burden to the county to support the project.
Yeah, that's an interesting model, because I definitely understand the tension with, you know, money that goes away. On the other hand, those funds, at least when there's stewardship, it stays local, you know, the investment. And if it's a timber sale, then some of it goes local, but some of it goes off to the contributor.
Sadly, in Oregon economy, jobs do not do anything for county government.
Right.
It does for state because of income tax and other things, but it doesn't come to the essential services that counties provide. And that's why the BLM, the 50%, goes back into essential services. U.S. Forest Service, so the 25%, only goes to roads projects. So if in those stewardship projects they go back and they fix the roads in the first place, then it's essentially a wash because it's just, but that's why we're still kind of, it's like, okay, in places like Washington where they have those projects, it's great because county services are paid by income taxes or non-income taxes in Washington, but sales tax and different things.
Yep.
So those jobs make a difference to county government. In Oregon, our structure is different. So
that they don't, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Gotcha. Thanks. And one last thing. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to share with another kind of pretty exciting development. So we had some, we being the OSU College of Forestry, had some property donated to us here just this past year. That's the couple, Bill and Marion Collins, who donated the property. I worked with them for about 20 years. They live up near Gold Hill, and they've had all sorts of educational events at their property. I've had tours there. They've hosted a forest and range day camp. They're really educationally public-minded. And so they gave us their property, 167 acres. And so we're really excited about turning this into a demonstration for us and doing a lot of classes and tours. And gives me a chance to go out and run my saw and do some work in the woods, which is always fun. So I think we'll be doing a lot here at the Collins Demonstration Forest.
Is there some meadows or is it all forest?
There is a pretty good meadow. But it's primarily, and some oak woodlands, but it's primarily forest.
Cool.
Yeah. Very nice. And Bill there, it's pretty remarkable. He turned 90 this year. So,
oh, God.
He's,
are they still living in the house?
We worked out a deal where they could stay on the, stay in their house and keep going.
That's great.
It's pretty awesome. Wow. All righty. That's me.
Thanks, Max.
I had one question of you, the dumping that goes on forest roads that we're also real proud of, other people's kids, is there any program through your organization that does any forest cleanup, or do you know of any?
I don't. We don't, through Extension, we don't have a program that does that. I believe there is an organization out there, I can't remember the name, that had kind of an initiative to do some cleanup. I mean, it's a terrible problem.
I know. Most people don't drive those roads, unless you're a gun enthusiast or something. And I don't go out but once every few years, but I was shocked.
Yeah.
I'm out there all the time. You go over, there's a little wide spot in the road. You look down there, there's a refrigerator, a stove.
A hulk of a burned car.
Yeah. But I wonder about education to the youth programs and talking about, hey, your forest, if you're just filling them up with landfill, then you're not going to have a forest. And I mean, how did you get a whole generation to change behavior? You go to the kids and teach them this isn't where you dump your trash, kind of stuff. Then.
Yeah. You got to go back to why did it even start in the first place? And what used to be, you could go out to the dump, and it was a landfill, and you just took it out there for a couple of bucks. You threw it in the landfill. People did that. As soon as the landfill went from $2 to $10 to $20 to $30, people don't go to the dump anymore, and then you couldn't have a landfill. Now you got to drive it all the way to Medford, or you have to go through Southern Oregon Sanitation or Republic. They all charge to get rid of the stuff, and rightfully so. It costs money to get rid of it. When you take all of that stuff away from the people, guess what? They're going to go dump it out in the woods. Because you didn't have any of this when you had active forest people in the woods every day. They wouldn't catch a guy with a garbage, with a whole back end of his truck full of garbage, because they'd probably run over him with a logging truck. But the problem is, it never happened before until all of a sudden the cost of getting rid of refuse, and as soon as that landfill closed out there, it was horrible. And that's what started it. So don't go back to when it worked. Let's figure out what we can do now. And you're not going to stop people. You go out and clean it all up. And they go, wow, they got this all cleaned up. Back up here, Ruth. We'll just dump it here.
The easy
start all over again because there's no place else for them to take it for either free or nominal charge.
And couldn't the government, in some form or fashion, federal, state, by a grant, have a free dump day once a month or something where the government picked up the tab to try and keep some of that from happening?
I would be curious to get Douglas County's response where they provided free dump service for how many years and still have.
Well, let's see what Douglas County starts
looking like. It's going to start looking like more, but I would bet that their forests aren't free of garbage, even with free dump service.
It's hard to change habits. It really is.
Or how many people dump on their own properties and just, I mean, it's,
dig a hole and put some really bad stuff in there?
All right.
Well, we'll keep going.
All right.
We're wearing them out. We only got one more.
Left you 6 minutes, Gordon.
Perfect. I'm on it. My name is Gordon Jones. I have the nimble title of Assistant Professor of Practice in General Agriculture. And that's what I was sort of hired as a county agent of a person who could come, people could come to, involved in commercial agriculture and ask questions and get answers either on the spot or in the near future. I sort of liaise with campus and try to provide technical expertise towards agriculture and land management in the county and both Jackson and Josephine. I'm based down in Central Point at SoRec.
So but like business agriculture primarily or even private?
Commercial agriculture.
That I guess I don't quite understand. There's not that much corporate agriculture besides Harry and David.
I guess that's true.
That I, as Sarah mentioned, that most of the farming property in both Jackson and Josephine counties does classify as a small farm, and so we have small farms folks that support them. I do as well, and in maybe a way where I focus more on the sort of technical, how do we actually grow plants? What are you actually going to do with your soil? What's wrong with that? What's the disease on your crop and how do we fix it? Okay. Versus the community marketing, what business should I go into kind of side of things.
Well, that didn't isn't the breaking point between small farm and large farm $350,000 worth of product?
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at an industry that's right here that's $350,000 is an acre.
Let's talk about that.
Small farm by
you had to go there, didn't you?
I'm going to go there because it's on the forefront.
It's on the next slide.
It used to be that there was an acre of marijuana. Now there's 20 acres of hemp. And all the stuff that came along, the nuances and the complaints about marijuana are going to go to hemp. Now I don't have 1 acre next to me. I got 20 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a small farm.
That's great. I support all sizes of agriculture, and I try to help all the various land uses as best I'm able to. My job description says that I will either answer questions or refer questions related to all aspects of agriculture. And so I get all sorts of things that come to my desk. They get passed to me from folks like the Master Gardeners and Sarah, who either don't have time or the expertise to work on certain issues. They come to my desk, and I do my best to answer them. It really is quite diverse in terms of what I do. I was encouraged as I arrived, I guess, 23 months ago here in Southern Oregon to pick a few areas to focus on and start with those. And then my general agriculture appointment will evolve as time goes on. And there certainly is the evolving landscape of agriculture in that we've got to evolve with it. My sort of scientific training and expertise is in pasture and forage management and in terms of acreage of land in both Josephine and Jackson counties. Pasture and forage are the largest land use of agricultural land in the valley, and so we train people through one-on-one site visits, a whole range of courses both here and in Jackson County on how do we grow a pasture system that will be healthy for your animals so you don't have to buy a lot of feed in, that will be free from noxious weeds that would cause issues to neighbors, that won't have erosion problems of moving soil off your property into streams and waterways, and can keep manure and bacteria and nutrients from moving as well. So that's one focus area that I've been working on and offer a range of classes, both indoors and outdoors, in doing that. Next slide, please. The next area that I work on is soil fertility, soil health, and cover cropping. I'm an agronomist by training, and so can really get your soil tested and get you a fertilizer plan that will grow a optimal yield of crops, and so train people that we don't necessarily just need to go to Home Depot and buy a bag of fertilizer, but we can really evaluate what your specific plant and your specific soil needs and apply those things and do that in a healthy and safe way. I've done some dabbling in pollinator work, that some of the pasture land that we have and open space is sort of fallow or not very well utilized in terms of grazing animals or forage harvest, and so there are folks who are interested in increasing the forage resource, the nectar and pollen for pollinators, and so have done some experiments down at the research station on looking at how do we actually grow a community of plants that will be stable and will continuously provide pollen and nectar source for pollinators, and so that's been an interesting project and sort of a different angle on the work that I've done in the past, and again, offer evening classes. I have pretty good success offering an hour and a half to 2 hour class in the one night a week, and can get 20 or 30 or 50 people to show up and listen to a topic and talk both about sort of the scientific principles of what we're doing and why we're doing them, and then how on the ground do we actually go about carrying out these best practices. And then I offer people help and end up getting phone calls afterwards and go out and drive all over the county and talk to folks and see things on the ground. Next slide, please. And then one further area that I've been focused on is pesticide stewardship. I guess this is particularly related to the sort of large horticultural production, pears and wine grapes in the Rogue Valley, and thinking about the potential for some of those materials that are used to move off-site and cause issues with neighbors, with water quality, with pollinators, as we mentioned. And so support a program that is called a Pesticide Stewardship Partnership. Looks at water quality in the Bear Creek Basin, and we find a whole range of agricultural chemicals in Bear Creek, and so then try to feed that information back to growers and say, if we want to keep using these materials, we've got to figure out ways to keep them from ending up in the streams, and do all sorts of programs on calibrating sprayers and understanding weather conditions in which drift might occur, and understanding the properties of various chemicals, if they're likely to run off your field or get stuck to the soil and stay in place. And so those areas are ones that I'm focusing my outreach program on presently: pastures and forage, soils, and this pesticide stewardship. But we certainly have this new crop in the region that it requires our attention, certainly. We have sort of a challenge because the university has been fairly timid about approaching the genus of cannabis, either marijuana or hemp, and it has just been since the end of December of 2018 that they've allowed us to have any conversations with hemp growers or hemp growers at all. I'm currently prohibited from talking by the university from talking to marijuana growers, but I can engage with hemp growers so long as they're licensed with the Department of Agriculture. And this year they've learned that, and they have certainly been calling. That I get questions on all sorts of topics of irrigation, soil management, the plastic that they use, questions about, I want to lease out my land for a hemp grower to grow hemp. What should I write in this contract? What should I be worried about? And vice versa. I want to come to town and grow hemp. How do I find some land and a potential person to rent from? And so we deal with sort of a range of issues with that. The challenge in the sort of technical side is that there hasn't been a century's worth of plant science research on really what the best way to grow hemp is, exactly what nutrients are required, what the best strains are. And so leave me sort of in a challenged position of, I can tell you how to grow plants well and general things we worry about in agricultural systems, but I don't have all the answers for hemp specifically. We're working on changing that. We just, I guess when I looked yesterday, a planting of hemp that we did down at SOREC in Central Point is just out of the ground, and we're part of a statewide experiment that's getting done at maybe 10 research stations around the state. That's sort of a first OSU effort into field experimentation with hemp, and we'll look at planting dates and planting rates and some various management activities on hemp. It's unfortunately not the same type of hemp that the growers in southern Oregon are growing. Here they're growing drug-type CBD hemp for extractable oil. Since CBD isn't either a medicine or a supplement per the FDA, the university won't allow us to specifically work on CBD. And so we're working using fiber-type hemp that the Canadians grow in our experiment this year. But hopefully as time goes on, as growing seasons
What do the Canadians do with fiber-type hemp? Do they have manufacturing facilities to use it for cloth and rope and things? Because I think there was an article in the paper the other day said, great, grow all the fiber hemp you want. There's nowhere to take it in the United States. We don't have that infrastructure in place. It used to be used years ago to do all kinds of stuff. We got away from it. Now that's got to be an emerging industry, I'm going to assume.
I am going to assume as well.
Does fiber, you're working with fiber hemp down there?
Mm-hmm.
Does it smell?
Yep. And so that certainly is a sort of challenging, sort of interesting, and clearly important part of my work. And so I trust that when I come back next year, I'll have a full program area on the working on education.
And this is a long time ago. I don't expect anybody in the room to remember this, but I live just out the end of Bridge Street, and the hops, when they get ripe, mm-hmm. marijuana is basically, they're in the same family as hops. And boy, when those things bloom out, we live just east of that, and it was, and the roads were green when they harvested it, and they had trucks overusing. They have exact same condition or concerns with the hops that we do with marijuana. And they're so close together, but there's a difference.
Yeah, it's I guess that's part of the challenge of sort of living in a place where agriculture is in a matrix with where people live, is that there will be dusty, smelly, noisy activities that sort of are required to go on with the agriculture, and that there currently is law that allows farmers to do those things. They may disturb neighbors, but it's their right to farm, and it certainly is my expectation that as time goes on and economies and laws change, we will always see some change in agriculture, and that change will be kind of difficult because I'm used to the way things always were. There was a certain amount of traffic on the road. There was a certain smell in the air at a time of the year, and now that's shifting, and I appreciate that that's difficult for people to deal with, but it partly is the way that agriculture works, is that there are new products that get grown, and people are going for the best markets, and
the uniqueness in our county is that previous boards allowed agricultural activities to happen on all rural residential land. Mm-hmm. And so where in other counties statewide you will have designated agricultural mm-hmm. properties, EFU lands, we don't have an exclusion on any of our lands here. And when we looked at that, what we found is because we are predominantly small farms, mm-hmm. There was concern about eliminating that. And so it is a little more integrated and invasive in residential.
Right, so right next
correct.
Door. Yep, I can appreciate the difficulty there. And I guess I'm curious about what the long term production of hemp will be in southern Oregon. We certainly are in a gold rush time now, and we can look at acres planted over the past few years or licenses that have been provided in Jackson and Josephine counties, and it is exponential growth, and that's sort of what happens when you see a new market open up, and at some point there will be a leveling out and a sort of attenuation of that, the intensity of the people coming in to do that growing, and I don't know if that will be in 3 years or in 10 years, but it will probably look somewhat different and than it does in 2019.
That's safe to say.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, can say that with confidence.
He didn't say in what way it's going to be different. He just said it's going to be different.
Yep.
So, yeah.
He chose his words carefully.
And I guess I have one more slide there. And so as part of this, so I teach these classes. This is just classes from 2019 thus far. Again, this is just my second year. I think I overbooked my spring with teaching too much, but it was pesticide and worker protection training in January, managing troublesome weeds in your pasture or riparian area in February, talked to the wine grape growers about vineyard nutrition in March, was up here at the Seeds of Spring, came and talked to the master gardeners about safe pesticide use in smaller sites, talked about soils and organic matter, how to renovate and replant pastures and hay fields, to just general pasture management, and then recently in the beginning of May had a course on how much do we irrigate, how do we figure out how much water you actually want your crops need. And so that's just sort of a set of things that I've taught, and that will evolve as time goes on, and we'll repeat some of those and offer new things as we see a need.
Where would I find information on a weed called a silo? Can I just go online?
Right. I would just go online and Google it and say, how do you control?
Where would I find that? Because yep. Last night at the airport board meeting out in the Cave Junction, they are out there picking each asylum weed and capturing the seeds and the flowers and stuff. Like, this stuff is just taking over, and boy, look out, it's going to go absolutely nuts and ruin the whole thing. And I don't know what it's like.
They've been doing it for years.
They've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
And they go out there and fly over it, and they walk and crawl it on their hands and knees like it's...
And so, right, so a good job for me is to say, what do I call me and say, what do we do with this wheat? And then I will spend a few hours or a half a day and do an internet search and call somebody on campus. And
got a yellow flower.
And I've got all sorts of books on things, and I'll say, seems like you've got four choices, and it makes sense why they're hand pulling it. Or if you're willing to spray, you spray this at this time of year. I can give you some recommendations on what to do.
That might be very helpful. They're really going over the overboard. They walk out there almost daily.
Yep. There are often better ways to do things. You just have to find those better ways.
Well, I have a question. I'm not sure if it's in your wheelhouse or not, or if it's somewhere else in the system. But every few years, we have the communities of Josephine County. They kind of bubble up on the subject of roadside vegetation management. And right now, we're in the middle of another pretty intense discussion with the Roundup nationwide getting taken to court. And so we have an opportunity to look at roadside management. Do you guys get into that?
I do somewhat through the pesticide stewardship work that I do. That some of the chemicals we find in Bear Creek in Jackson County are ones that are applied on the roadside, because lots of those places don't have actual soil. It's just gravel, and so there's not much to hold on to those chemicals and water running off the roads. That we spend some time thinking about alternatives, and sometimes it's a case of, like, we switched from one herbicide to another one because it makes it look like we didn't herbicide the vegetation. It doesn't die looking the same way like it's been herbicided, and so that's more suitable to the public and can talk about the reality of those Roundup questions and say, I can appreciate what's happened in courts in California, but we also have a science of toxicology. And the science of toxicology would tell us that bacon is more likely a carcinogen than Roundup is. And so,
how dare you say that?
I know. It's your bacon.
Don't come in here and attack bacon.
I apologize. But the folks who are professionals evaluating the risks that we take in dealing with various things tell us that alcohol and bacon are more likely going to cause cancer than Roundup is. And so we've got to say there are risks and benefits to everything we do. And if it is hand-pulling every weed, and if you've spent all summer hand-pulling every weed, you can appreciate the benefit of being able to have a chemical to use to control weeds. And if you've never done that, then you just see
and
the risk.
And I want to follow up.
And
if
you just see the risk because you've never engaged in that vegetation management, and you don't see the benefit, then we get sort of out of kilter. But I am happy to have conversations with folks about what chemicals are you using, what are the risks, what are the alternatives. That is in my wheelhouse. And
then keep that card close, Dan.
We may want you to get. We've had one and a half workshops on roadside vegetation. Real robust conversation on it. We're following up on it. Lane County has some stuff that they use up there that doesn't seem to harm anything.
Well, wait, because I talked to Lane County Commissioner.
Well, then I'll back out of it, and you can talk to him. But this was all through that. Deal we had. We just had kind of a round table.
Yeah.
Long discussion about it. So it is something, but
that it might move.
Everything I've heard about Bear Creek over the years, and Bear Creek doesn't get any better. Have you ever thought about just diverting Bear Creek through your treatment plant and before it goes back into the river?
That hasn't come up in my time, but
you've been there 2 years. Why haven't you fixed it?
I can appreciate that there are... we end up with trade-offs of, I can say, use less herbicide, but then you till up your field, and we end up moving nutrients into the water rather than chemicals.
Yeah.
And so it certainly is a balancing act, and I am all for thinking about sort of integrative solutions that do move us to a better place rather than whack-a-moling the problem.
Well, and I think it would be great to have you come over and maybe with our public works and see if there's a way that we can look at what we're doing. Because I reached out to Lane County Commissioner because they had gone to a non-spray entirely, and what they found is that they had a noxious weed in their drainage there that if you mow it, it spreads, and it's actually poison to the cattle and horses. And so they had to go back to spray because all of a sudden it was adversely affecting their farms and their agriculture. Mm-hmm. And where they were trying to be anti-pesticide, it actually had the reverse effect of killing animals. And so
they've gone to weed burning, too, and they found out that the weed burning all of a sudden germinated a seed that made
something
it 2,800 degrees, and next thing you know, you got palm trees
and
out.
You know, it's like, so we're like you said, we're trying to have this effect, but it has this ulterior result, and so really looking at what's,
right.
We know that it costs four times as much to hand, you know, process versus the spray, and the spray kills it to the roots, so it's not going under the roadway where the mowing or the stuff does still get underneath the roadbed and the cost of that. But what's the health of the community? Mm-hmm. So that balance. So maybe we can partner.
Yeah, I'd be happy to help you puzzle through that.
Someone from the public's trying to get in. Would you tell them that we don't allow public?
Oh, we don't
input at workshops.
Not during this one.
Sorry.
We can talk right afterwards.
Tomorrow.
As soon as the bell hits.
Tomorrow.
We can talk to you afterwards, Bill.
Okay, yeah. That's good.
Okay.
Yeah, one of the. Yeah,
all right.
Other questions.
We'll be around afterwards.
Okay,
sure.
Thank you very much. Is that all?
Yes, I just threw the slide up. The top pictures were from last year when we did the presentation, and the two bottom pictures are what it looks like this year again.
It's working.
So, yes.
It's growing.
It's growing, and it's looking great, and we appreciate
that's awesome.
That we could remove that asphalt and put those in. So.
Well, and I had two questions for the whole group, not necessarily you, sir. Is anybody on the fair board from your organization?
On the fair board?
Yeah. No.
I do go to the meetings.
You do go to the meetings.
And they give a report out.
I just wanted to make sure that connection was there.
She's on the agenda every
month.
I'm on the agenda every month. Occasionally, I can't meet.
See you tonight.
Yep.
And I know that you're a statewide organization and that you represent. Has there been any discussions in your group about like solar encroachment, where they're taking up pasture land, or you know, changing the landscape a bit by putting in some of these solar farms? Are you guys involved in the decision making and the impact of that at all?
Not in the decision making, but
no.
if somebody wanted to have a conversation with me about is there a way that we could have solar panels and livestock in the same place,
right.
Space them in a way that the grass will still grow, I would try to give them. I would, because you can't
be able to
grass
give
grass grows better in shade.
I've been known to microwave my bacon, so you might.
That's right.
Put the solar farm and a big farm together, and I'll just it'll be on. Cooked on the hood.
Yep. Bacon is not our takeaway from this meeting.
Isn't that what you're supposed to do when you have agriculture? You talk bacon.
It's an
important subject.
I did see hogs in one of the first slides.
I just want to say thank you all for what you're doing in our
thank
community.
You very much.
And if there is further way for the county to be a part of getting the messaging out, we can partner in that way. I know we're also technically your board, but we have that ability to try to help spread the word, and we would like to be able to do that to continue to. I mean, we overlap in so many ways in the community, and Cheryl, you talked about that in every way, you know, in the ways that we can continue to be a part. So thank you all, and for your time. I look forward to this presentation. It gets me all reared up, and then it's like, okay, but where do we put it to practical use?
Yes.
And that's always. We sit through a lot of meetings, but we're not interested in just meetings. We're actually interested in getting things done. So.
And you guys seem to be in a world where you get to have meetings, but then you actually get to go do something about it afterwards, which is nice.
Yes.
That must be satisfying.
Is there anything else on our agenda?
Yes.
Yes.
Letter of support for Senator Beartrigger. Thank you very much, all of you.
Thank you.
And one plug I'll put in is, you know, just keep us in the loop with any planning for facilities, because we are friends.
The unspoken truth. Yes.
Would all of you please leave cards if you have cards, because I put them in my little thing, and we can just see that we get them through Wendy or whatever. Okay, Commissioner Morgan, you want to look at this? I can take number two, because Herman wanted that on today for sure.
Okay,
and it's just a quickie. Review of advisory board mental health minutes, liaison reports, and additional subjects.
Yep.
So, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so
okay.
The letter for
Let's go on.
Senator
Item number two,
Badger
letter of support for, thank you very much. Letter of support for Senator Herman Beartrager regarding the fire
Can
district.
I have you guys step outside if you're going to be talking further? We got to get through.
Yeah, we've got to get through this meeting.
Sorry about that.
Letter of support for Senator Herman Beartrager regarding fire district for the unprotected areas in Josephine County. Mm-hmm. He wants to know if we will author a letter to him saying that we are very interested in the, you know, like a solution for the unprotected areas.
Okay.
And I think he's going to take this to see if he can get funding for such a thing if it ever did pass the voter.
Yep.
And he called me about that on Friday, and I said the first opportunity for a meeting would be today. So that's what I wanted to bring up.
Does his bill have a bill number yet?
I don't know that.
Okay.
We just talked. I was on my way out of the parking lot, and I don't drive with the phone in my ear. So he said, "Just this is what I need you to do on Tuesday, if you can bring it to the board on Tuesday. Letter of support. Give him a call. He'd be glad to explain what he's up to up there. I'm not opposed to a letter. You know, I think we had that advisory question.
Yeah, the timing's a little
coming
tight.
On. Yeah, I don't think it is hinged to our advisory.
Right.
However,
keep it separate.
You know,
the biggest issue in our community is the poverty, the startup costs, the getting past that hump of, you know, how do we raise the economy across the board kind of thing, so they can afford housing because they can't afford all this other stuff. It's one of the things that impacts why people are worried about what would a district cost me? What's my bottom
exactly.
line?
Exactly. But I think we need to have the conversation. Do we support? Not necessarily a fire district, but I guess it would be a fire district because we're concerned about the unprotected areas. I think we're kind of out there a ways because we are the fire marshal. I think you said one time we're the
fire chief
for Josephine County.
Correct.
And we've got a lot of areas that are unprotected and people that don't have subscriptions and so on and so forth.
Yep.
What happens to them? Do we not offer anything?
Well, and honestly, there's been what's come to my attention through this process of learning is that under state law, only a government entity and a fire district can be reimbursed for those services. So, for instance, if you get in a crash in the city of Grants Pass, the city of Grants Pass can bill you for the cost of using their services if you don't live in our area. In the county areas, we don't have a district, so that means we are the only ones that could bill. There's entities that are private, for-profit entities that are billing.
That are billing. And
that
then,
don't have
yeah.
the authority to do so. But if it were a district, there could be reimbursement for that cost that goes back to the local citizens paying for
so
those
these
services.
These are conversations we have to have, but I would encourage you to call Senator Beartrager. I told him I'd bring it up at the meeting.
So what are your thoughts on a letter?
Yeah, I don't know the full what he's asking, but if it's something he needs to back up a bill, I say we do it, and then we'll know. If everybody says no, don't look into it, then
would you guys
we'll
like me to
die.
Call him and get a letter drafted
exactly.
and try to bring
you
it back this
it.
Afternoon?
You're the wordsmith.
That would be great.
Commissioner
okay.
Woodsmith.
I would be for that, yeah.
I don't know that I am, but I'd be happy.
You are. You've done really well. Thank you.
If we say it often enough, it might come true.
So you both are in support of us getting
yes.
something going, so I will follow up with that.
Copy.
As far as the next item,
item number
like,
three is review advisory board mental health minutes.
So, I don't know if you guys have seen our whiteboard. I should just give you a heads up. I met with Carla McCafferty, who is the executive director of Options, which is a nonprofit which the county contracts with to do mental health services in the community.
Mm-hmm.
LADPC is the local alcohol drug prevention council. And we also have the Board of Health. They meet on Thursdays, 3 weeks in a row every month. I spend my days going to meetings that overlap. And
right.
so I met with Carla and Sean Martinez, who's our prevention and treatment coordinator, and Mike Weber, our public health administrator, about if the potential of combining these three boards for the sake of how much of their stuff overlaps. And And so the general consensus is they thought that that would make sense.
Let's try it.
But they're going to make some recommendations of what are required by law to do, because that's what we've learned. We've had a Board of Health in Josephine County since 1937. We're not required by law to do it.
And we've had a couple months of LADPC being canceled for lack of agenda items, lack of membership in Board of Health, various things. And it's like, well, what can we do to find the things that have to be done? There's funding that goes through LADPC. So as much as we delve into this, we are looking at a more efficient way of getting the information to us. So we're going to come back with a recommendation to you guys. That includes what we are doing, a service to the community that's a need to do, and what is required by law to do, a recommendation for membership. And so we're meeting in another week or two, and then we'll bring this back. But it doesn't relate, but it kind of relates, because here's the minutes for the Mental Health Advisory Board. And so what I learned is the Mental Health Advisory Board, the state law requires that every program is to have an advisory board. So Options is required to have an advisory board, of which the members are appointed by the county commissioners. Hmm. And so the question was, well, who are they advising? Well, they're advising the commissioners. Well, no, it's the program has an advisory board. But Options has a separate board of directors. And so what's the Mental Health Advisory Board? Well, they advise the county. But that's how weird the law is.
Right, and some weird facings.
Yes, so anyhow, but one of the things they do, and I would recommend that we look at the minutes from last month or the month before, has an annual report of the programs that have been going on. And as a highlight, Options has really gone above and beyond in providing services to our community in partnership with Community Corrections, with the police department, the jail. They have workers that they have in the jail that are doing assessments. They have a crisis response team that is the police are calling, and they're coming to try to help divert somebody that's in crisis that can go through the hospital versus end up in jail. And the newest thing they've partnered with the city police on, you might have heard it at that last Lipstick when we were all three there, was city police partnering with mental health to go contact certain clients that are not checking in. So they're trying to intervene before they go into crisis, but not in a, well, the police are going for safety purposes, but not for a retaliatory, or you're not in trouble. It's more just a safety with the caseworkers. But the mental health behavioral justice reinvestment, we're looking at doing a call. There's a $20 million ask that they do with behavioral health, what they did with justice reinvestment, which would take money that people going to prison and try to, or the state hospital, and divert it to local services. So that's one of the things that the state legislature right now. The CCO model is really the biggest funding for mental health advisory. Carla did a report on that last month where the CCO 2.0, which is the new funding mechanism for renewing the CCO contracts. It used to be that all monies from the state passed through the counties, as were the local mental health authority, and were also the local public health authority. So the funding from the state would come to the counties, and we just distribute it to the programming. Well, with the CCOs, which are all care and primary health. Primary health and all care are the two CCOs. They contract directly with Options, and so have bypassed us. So there's just a small amount of funding that still comes through us. And there's been questions at various times, do we give up being the local mental health authority? But the biggest piece that comes through us that I would say we want to defend and not get rid of is the alcohol, drug, and treatment and prevention that still goes through us through Sean Martinez. And that's a part of being the local mental health authority. But we also are responsible for crisis stuff. So just finding out our obligations and stuff. Citizen engagement. So membership on the local mental health authority board. We have a public defender. We have our deputy juvenile director. We have a clergy member. We have citizens at large. We have a resident of Illinois Valley. We have our housing authority person and somebody from the mental health and advocacy group. That I just am blanking on the name of it.
NAMI.
NAMI, yes, thank you.
NAMI.
NAMI. National Association of... yeah, anyhow, they have an advocate on that group. And they're a very active group, but generally the meetings are informative where Carla will do a presentation.
Let's go back to this. You want to put all three of these together? I say yes.
Oh, that's not the agenda item. The minutes are the agenda items.
Okay.
I'm just thinking through the last few meetings of we canceled this month.
But there is a annual report in one of those meetings that I would recommend you all look at, because it just will give you an idea of the services we provide in our community through options. And since the county is a local mental health authority, it's not a bad idea. Often those things come to me because it's my liaison role, but I don't really know how to share it because it's not a program that we're directly supervising. So outside of the annual report would have been in the April minutes, I think.
Yep.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that went all the way to 18.
So Trish has those for us. So that would be the biggest summary that was vetted by the group of what services options has provided in the last year, and a good synopsis for you to have an understanding of what services are provided.
All right. Cool. January. February is as far as it goes.
Okay. Trish says she has them. She'll bring them to us.
Perfect.
So.
Well, should we take action on these today, though?
I don't know. The only action is as you read them, you sign them.
Okay.
And I think you can only sign the ones for this year.
Since I was never.
I think it's just the standard of going through if there's any highlights.
Okay.
The action has already happened in a weekly visit session previously. So we'll get through them and that. Wanted you to have a heads up that we are looking at making a restructuring recommendation that we'll bring back to you guys to evaluate from those three areas.
Sounds good.
Any liaison results, reports, I mean?
Yes, from the Illinois Valley Airport, they want to go to quarterly meetings instead of monthly meetings. I'm in favor of that. But during the monthly meetings, they're going to get a monthly update from the from the airport director for Illinois Valley. They voted on it last meeting. They had a motion and second and unanimous to go to quarterly meetings out there. They amended that last night because I thought we needed to have monthly manager, the directors send them a monthly update so that they're all set to go. They were in favor of that. So I said, we'll put something together and bring it to the board. I said, the board's the one that allows you to do the quarterly meeting.
We just need to look at the bylaws.
What's that?
The bylaws.
I think they've already looked at the bylaws,
but
we can do
that. But they can't change them. We have to change the bylaws.
Yeah, they want to recommend.
That's got to come back to here. They can't just do that with a motion from their stuff. It needs to come to the board. So they're going to bring that to the board probably next week sometime or the week after that.
Cool.
They want to initiate this starting July 1, so they're still going to have a June meeting, and they'll have a July meeting, and then that'll kick off the quarterly from then on. We did have a robust discussion about the purchase and lease agreement out there. By the time all the dust settled, and there really wasn't any dust, the board agreed that it was a good sale. The sale and lease agreement were good for the smoke jumpers, good for the airport, good for the airport board. They're all on board with it. So that's good. I promised them, and come to find out, historically, this is not the first time that they have not been notified of something. So one of the things that they were kind of upset a little bit about was that we didn't know anything about the details and all of that stuff. And Aaron said, stop right there. He said, I've done so many real estate transactions and been part of real estate transactions on both the buying side, the selling side, and the negotiating side. Nobody's business until the final thing comes out. Because it's very similar to what we do, land things at executive session here. And they go, oh, gee, we never thought of that, so it was okay. The public information request thing from Don Pappas, we discussed that quite heavily. Past commissioner, former commissioner Sandy Cassanelli was there, and she was helpful because Mr. Pappas wanted all the stuff, and then he would weed through it to see what was pertinent, and that isn't how that works. When you have that public request that comes through legal, and legal divvies out, and she agreed with that. So I think Mr. Pappas was more understanding, but it was really a good meeting. Director Graves was not there. He was on his way out there and got in a wreck right after...
Oh.
We talked about, now you be careful on that drive out there, Dad, Commissioner, because that's a bad road. And he calls when I get there. He says, yeah, Larry won't be here. He got in a wreck.
He's all right, though.
Yeah, he's fine.
Okay.
Well, no, a car hit a car, that car hit his car. So he's fine.
Collateral damage.
But it was just kind of odd that we talked about that right before it happened. So they had a good meeting out there last night, and I concur that you know what the transparency really does need to be the key word out there, because they've had history, not with this board, but they've had history in the past of various things, you know, that have kind of gone unchecked out there that the board, and they say, you know, why are we an airport advisory board if we're not in the loop to advise? And they made pretty good.
One of the things that came to my attention is that there's a discrepancy on the membership out there. There's two members that are listed as backups or alternates.
Yeah.
And at some point when there were vacancies, they were told they were put in the permanent positions, but in our records, they're still in the alternates.
They're still alternates.
So they have been operating as if they are not an alternate. And those positions have been filled. So the membership...
This is a time to get that all cleared up. I think that'd be a great time going into the new fiscal year. I think if we have concerns with them, I think now's the time
to get
all
ironed. Well, this is one of my concerns with all of our advisory boards that I'm hoping the office manager position will be able to tackle and get a handle on. Trish has tried to bring it up to speed best we can, but this is some of the things that are coming out is... it hasn't been well monitored, and it's really, since they are our advisory board, part of that is if we're engaged as the liaisons or the knowledgeable about the bylaws for our advisory boards, then we're utilizing them to the best of, or amending those bylaws so we can utilize them better. I mean, they should be living ongoing process that, mm-hmm. you know, what was the authority to exist? Well, look at the Board of Health, for instance. It was created in 1937 when the county was providing all health services. Through the era of the state taking over, even though we're local mental health authority, through the CCO model, so much is happening different. A lot of things are changing, and our bylaws don't update with those times necessarily.
Right.
So this is an opportunity for us to make sure that are we just doing what we've always done, or is it serving a purpose that is beneficial
right.
to the time
right.
of them
Does
and
it
us?
Need some updating? Or
correct. So,
gotcha.
Okay, that's the only liaison report I have.
And I don't have any for today.
Okay.
You're going on to the next one?
No.
Okay, five is additional subject matters for commissioners.
Okay.
Or did you have something for the liaison?
I was trying to think of... There is a couple topics that will be coming to you guys soon, but we'll get it... It doesn't matter to bring it up. So, yeah, we can go on to additional matters.
I need to know what happened to the when and who for K-Joe, because that's all gone.
Yeah.
We took pictures of it.
Did you? You have a picture of it? Okay, that's all I need to pick.
We moved parks up to April, so May we didn't have anybody designated. So it was just us for May.
Okay.
And I need to follow up with K-Joe as far as that third slot, if they've
right,
talked
if
about it, considering more. Otherwise, if they're just giving us the fifth ones. I'll wipe this off and get. We'll get back going on some of the stuff. But we took pictures so we wouldn't lose
okay,
the details.
Cool.
So the WIR conference,
update us.
You know, it's supposed to talk about natural lands. They delved into alcohol and drug and housing issues as well, which kind of seemed interesting, but it is what everybody's dealing with. But going up to the Colville forest area up there and just their way of treating the lands. They are doing the good neighbor. They have a collaboration locally that has taken 17 years to develop. But basically they've taken it all away from it. It used to be the U.S. Forest Service would do the NEPA, is that the environmental assessment? And the assessments of how much it cost to do the treatment and all this. Well, they changed it so that they would put out a bid, and whichever company got the bid does then all the process. And at the end, they get the sell, and they get to go that route. So it was kind of curious, but the biggest piece of it is they have the infrastructure, where they have the Vaughan Brothers mill there, and they can handle the processing, and they got rail to get it out of there, and they got, if they can, they don't use rail, they use trucks. for costs. But even they, in a community that is primarily timber related in that community still, they have a very low employment rate, but they still struggle to get employees that want to work. They said by standard, anybody that comes in and says, I came from a farm, they're hired on the spot because they know how to work.
All right.
But everybody is struggling with workforce and that process. But there was thought of how do we see about that down here. So the OSU thing kind of tied in with the Rogue Forest Restorative Initiative that they have that $6 million grant here. It's kind of curious how that ties in. And I was able to get Tim Freeman connected up with the Colville Commissioner, Stevens County Commissioner up there, because Tim has been anti any good neighbor or a collaborative because of the revenues back to the county. So seeing how they repaired a county road and covered the infrastructure cost, how do they do that? Because if it's just going to roads anyhow on the 25%, then it might have equaled out. So just trying to bring some of that information back so that it'll go to the ONC folks and get that information. The next year's one is down in Mariposa County, California, which is on the edge of Yosemite. I was disappointed with some of the classes they had this time, as far as it seemed like when we hosted in Bend, there was a lot more there. And the ONC group did a great presentation, which made me realize is that I received, coming in as a new commissioner, several ONC presentations where they presented a WIR, then they went around to every BLM district and they presented to all the BLM staff and asked local leadership to show up as well. And I haven't seen that happening lately. So Court Boyce and I were talking about trying to do a District 4, which is Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Hughes, and Curry, District AOC meeting on the front end of our next ONC meeting in Curry County next month, to try to see if we could kind of just have the region touch base pre-fire season. And kind of see, you know, get us all on the same page in connection with the ONC stuff. I think it's just too much information that I think we all should be a part of some of those conversations, but right. I don't want to step on toes either. It's just a matter of how do we all make sure we're getting the information, because it'll be a time that you're asked to speak to a citizen group on a fire district. And when have we touched base about, oh, wait, by the way, did you know?
Did you know, right.
And that kind of thing. So anyhow.
You have a month to put that together. You better hurry.
I know.
I'm just telling you, I've got to get that. Court and I have been emailing.
We had to finally get the blessing from AOC, who didn't give it to us until this week up there. And so it was kind of one of those things Court and I have been asking. And they finally said, well, the chair can call a meeting. I said, I'm the chair. He's the co-chair. We're trying to call a meeting. And so they finally said, okay, here's what our concerns were about staffing and all that other kind of stuff. So, all right, I won't tie it more because we're at noon. Did you guys have further?
That's it. That's the legal update at 2.
Okay. So with that, we can be adjourned.
Budget committee at 4.
11:42.